better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3701 of the Survival Podcast. And I'm in a good mood. It's a little bit late for a live stream. Jeff Lawton's going to be on with us in just a moment. I'm always excited when I have Jeff on. I think he is probably the number one permaculture practitioner, designer, and consultant in the world. And I feel incredibly blessed that he is in any way associated with this show, especially being an expert council member and answering your questions for you. About almost every week we have Jeff on with some sort of an answer for you guys. So we're going to be talking to Jeff in just a minute. We're going to be talking about some new mapping technologies, new information systems, including some AI stuff. We've talked about AI a lot recently. We're going to talk about the power of podcasts, permaculture courses online, local communities and groups, some climate analog stuff, just a whole bunch of stuff. Before we do that, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day. And sponsor of the day, number one today, is canineacademy.us. That's Joel Riles' operation. If you want to train your dog, I don't care what you want the dog to do. You want to start with core canine obedience. If you have a dog that's a bird dog for hunting, he's not going to be good if he doesn't have core obedience. A livestock guardian dog, not good without core obedience. A protection dog, not good without, you know, core obedience. Just a good homestead dog that doesn't eat your chickens, you need the core obedience. So I recommend you at least take that course there. There's other courses you can take at Canine Academy that go up another level with it. Joel's an amazing guy. He's a personal friend. And I even worked with him a great deal on putting the program together at Canine Academy. It won't let you down, I promise. And if you just want to find out if it's right for you, there's a free course there called the Problem Solving Library. Sign up for that and just see how Joel teaches, and I think you'll want to go further. Next up today, we have, let me get that out of the screen there, Above Phone. Do you know if you have a phone from like Apple or like an Android or something like that in regular service and all that, your provider spies on you. The app makers spy on you, and your carrier spies on you, and then they take your data and they sell it to basically anybody that wants to buy it, and they, of course, hand it over to the government. I'm not really that worried about that. I value my privacy, and with Above Phone, you can take back your privacy. Even if you're not ready to step into an Above Phone yet, check out what they have available at abovephone.com right there, a free guide. 5 must-change privacy settings. If you're not ready to make the leap yet, at least make the existing device you have a little bit more private. Remember, if you're an MSB member, you get $75 off any phone at Above Phone. And if you think it's going to be kind of hard to transition over to an Above Phone, it's really easy. But they give you a free one-hour consultation with an expert to help onboard you to your new phone. So check them out today at abovephone.com. With that, it's my good pleasure to welcome back to the Survival Podcast one of my favorite people in the world, Jeff Lawton. Jeff, welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you. It's been here. It's been a while.
It has been a while. And, of course, everything was fine until we started, and now Jeff's locked. There he goes. You were locked up and a little modulated there, but I think we're good now. For folks that haven't heard of you, I think most of my audience has. We've got new people every day, though. Give us kind of your backstory, like, you weren't always a permaculturist. You did other things in your life. How did you find permaculture, and what made you decide to dig into it as deeply as you have? I mean, it's basically your life now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it has been for
a long time.
100% 1991. Okay. I discovered permaculture in Australia in about 1979, 1980. I just emigrated from England. So I was born in England. And I grew up I was 16 in 1970. Okay. I lived through the 70s as an adolescent kind of thing. And we had dreams of this sort of self-sufficient style. It was where it all sort of started in some ways. But nobody had a real plan. It was just kind of dreams. And reality was a little bit different, trying to survive. And I ended up emigrating to Australia and then came across permaculture and kind of resonated with those old dreams. And it was just started. We were Bill was starting to teach, Bill Mollison was starting to teach permaculture about 1979, and I was just arriving, and this name was around, and I happened to, by accident, end up settling in an area in Australia where it was a bit of a hot spot, and so I was, it was kind of curious, the name was curious, and I saw people at shows, and there was a local group, and they were sort of presenting permaculture to the general public. And then as I got involved, I realized that was really interesting. It was like a roadmap to living in a more sustainable, self-sufficient way, self-reliant way. And it resonated with those old dreams. So it started there. And then I ended up taking an intro course with a local teacher, Max Lindegger. He's a permaculture consultant who started the first permaculture eco-village, Crystal Waters, which happened to be nearby as well. So it was all a bit of coincidence. And then I signed up for a course with Bill in 1983. I learned to consult, partnering with other people. I started consulting part-time, and it was early days, pre-internet. So it wasn't the same volume of information we have now and reference material. But it was 1991 when I sort of stepped over the line and decided I was going to teach, I was going to consult, and I was going to do nothing else but work in permaculture. And it's all just exploded from there. I've ended up as an international teacher, international consultant. And I've been lucky to follow technology as well. Early days making a lot of videos and films and early technology type films like flash videos, and being on a spot where I made videos of interesting projects, particularly in the Middle East, because it's kind of a geopolitical hotspot and still is very, very much. And country after country, having that sort of luck of using technology to make good videos, signing up on Facebook, Instagram, and all those sort of social media sites very early, I built an audience and a following. And my teaching's been quite successful. I've created a lot of active people, and that's what I set out to do. I don't hide anything, whether it's good or bad. All the mistakes are out there as well as the good successes. I love practical work. I've set up my own farms, my own demonstration sites, my own education centers, my own institutes. I like the professional approach. I like taking on big jobs. I like challenges. I'm definitely not a sort of airy-fairy permaculturist. I don't go for holding hands and playing games and all those sort of things. I work
in the mud.
Yeah, no, I'm very professional. I present permaculture as a serious business that we need to get on with. And having worked in war zones, I went through Iraq, and I went through early days in Guatemala, the war in Guatemala. I've worked in dangerous places where you have to be serious, and it kind of changes you anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't come out of a war zone unchanged. So emergency aid was my first touch for that sort of conflict. I got him from aid work, general aid work, to emergency aid is quite a jump. And then from emergency aid to war zone work is the final jump. You can't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere. There's nothing worse. So I'm not long come back from the Middle East. I was underneath rocket fire. I was feeling the ground thumping and jumping. I'll be back there pretty soon. I'm still riding that sort of zone, and I'm okay with it. Because I have to be. And that's what attracts people to my courses. I've got an actual course on running right now. I've got a co-teacher. Actually, my brother-in-law now, Sam Parker Davis, is teaching today, so I'm okay talking to you. they're doing early morning work, turning compost, milking cows, and doing a few pre-course things for those who want to get involved, and they'll be teaching all day. I finished patterns yesterday. I did methods of design and pattern, and you know what that means, pattern understanding. Yeah.
Yeah.
There'll be climate factors and trees and energy transactions today. That we have a very large, diverse demonstration site here at Zaytuna Farm, and now it's a permaculture eco hamlet. I have eight households here now. So I've got eight personal gardens, family gardens. People can look at eight different types of houses. It's quite changed. That's where I come from. That's what I do. And I like training people to take on big jobs and work with high tech stuff and the internet and the satellite LIDAR work, mapping work. I've done an awful lot of work on that in the last few years. And now I've even got some AI. So it's just an ever-changing world. And, since you and I have been talking, it's changed.
Yeah. Oh, it's much. Dramatically different. I mean, if I go back to 2008, I was always into, I guess you'd call it just organic gardening. I mean, I grew up with it in the 70s and 80s with a grandfather that, that ran a garden of about a quarter acre. And it was not a hobby. Like, we were not well off financially. It was a significant part of our food stores to our home. And I found you and Bill in 2008. Somebody sent me an email, said, you got to look at this. And it was your original Greening the Desert, which was not exactly a high-value production, but it hooked me instantly. I had been bitching. I'd moved here to Texas. And this is a much more difficult climate than central Pennsylvania, where I grew up. Central Pennsylvania, if you throw a tomato into the yard in May, it'll probably, one of the seeds will catch and it'll grow. I mean, you almost can't do it wrong. Here is a lot harder, and I've been kind of complaining about it. Somebody sent me that video of you and the work you guys did in Jordan, and I went, okay, I can't complain anymore. I got to learn about this. And then I heard about this permaculture thing because of that video, and I'm like, it sounds like some hippy-dippy stuff. And the next video I found was Bill, and I think it was part of the Global Gardener series or something like that. And this old crusty dude, and he's like, I decided I could either go back into the woods and forget about it all and let the bastards roll over it, but I couldn't live with that. So I came back to fight the bastards, and I'm like, okay, I can get behind this. And that's kind of like the two of y'all were my, and I think for many people, my permaculture genesis story. And it is kind of an infectious thing. It got into my veins, and I can't get it out. I don't want to. It's just a different way of looking at the world. And it also permeates into everything. So when you said patterns and pattern recognition, once you learn pattern recognition, you can't watch the news no more. Because you know it's all BS. As soon as they start talking, you're like, I know what he's going to say next because the pattern is set. And so, like, the pattern thing alone is probably worth digging into it because – it just unfolds in front of you then, the patterns and everything, not just the visual patterns or the audio patterns, but the patterns of behavior, whether it's an organism in a system or a talking head on a TV. You see those patterns everywhere.
Hmm. Weren't you in Arkansas when we first
spoke? I was here, but then I went to Arkansas and came back.
Oh.
So I did 3 years up in Arkansas, and that was much easier than here. That was actually it rains more there. It rains a lot there. And when I moved back here, one of our mutual, connections, Nick Bertner, said, I'm a permaculture masochist. I like to take on hard properties. And this one's kind of tough. I mean, a lot of this property has 4 or 5 inches of dirt on top of limestone. Right. But you can make things work anywhere. We certainly have here, when I moved in, 90% of the vegetation in the summer was sandburrs. It was sandburrs everywhere. You can't find one now.
Yeah.
People are like, how'd you do it? I'm like, well, I mowed it the right time of year and the ducks did it. The ducks increased the fertility and drove it out. It's almost any problem we have, there's a solution to it, at least if it's a natural problem. And almost all problems are natural or anti-natural, maybe.
Often the problems like the sandburrs are just a symptom that you can use as an indicator of what to do. I think the first time we spoke online, because I didn't know who you were, and I wasn't sure, and this sort of prepping movement and American gun scenario and everything, I'm thinking, who is this guy? And you were in Arkansas, and you said, when you come, I said, oh, I'm pretty puffed. I just unloaded like 8 cubic yards of compost out of a trailer that I'd just shipped in. I thought, okay, I think I can talk to this guy.
That sounds about right. And that probably, you know what, that's probably when we first connected. I was in Arkansas. That's probably about right. And I owe Paul Wheaton for that. On your notes that you submitted to be on the show this time. Oh, you want to go ahead and say something? Go ahead.
No. I'm just, Paul always makes me smile.
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't explain why, but there's many reasons. But yeah. Anyway, my notes. What were we going to talk about? You mentioned it at the start of the show there, I think.
Yeah, you have some stuff in here about new mapping technologies, and I have a feeling it has to do with some of the stuff we were chatting about while we were getting ready before we went live.
Yeah. Well, I turned my screen around because I thought I could show maps behind me, but I'm working on a big 85-inch BenQ interactive whiteboard, the state-of-the-art sort of classroom interactive whiteboard, because I want to be able to teach people how to map, how to design with high-tech maps. Now, as long as they keep the bloody satellites open, with your NASA shutdown, we might be in trouble. In recent times, I'm sure you know some of the news is out there. You know, what we're going to be allowed to see or not see is maybe questionable. Maybe we have to use Chinese satellites or something. But I've been, for 8 years, I've been working with Ben Missimer from Pearl River Eco Design, who's a student of mine with quite a technical military background. He did his permaculture design certificate course with me online and then was frustrated that he couldn't get the sort of data he wanted. And he's a bit of a technological type guy. So he invested in all the computing skills and equipment he needed. And he ended up sending me a map of Zaytuna Farm, of this property here, he printed it. So it arrived as a laminated roll in the post, what it was. Anyway, he didn't tell me. He'd been working with my son and daughter, who are both involved in permaculture. My son's a permaculture earth mover. My daughter is a technologist and one of my main editors for my videos. But he'd worked with them confidentially and help map this place at a distance. And I opened this thing, didn't know what it was, this roll, and this map came out. And I've never seen a map of this place like that. It wasn't perfect. There was a couple of mistakes here and there, but it was better than I'd ever seen. And I love maps because, like Bill always said, maps are one of our main tools. And then I Skyped him, which we can't do anymore, but I Skyped him straight away. Mm-hmm. And I said, was this? How did you do this? And it was LiDAR technology translated into a user-friendly form. It wasn't just LiDAR, raw data. It was LiDAR that had been manipulated to be easy to read for a permaculture designer and a permaculture client.
Wow.
And I just got in a conversation with him. And then it was like, it never stopped. We've been working together ever since. Very close. And I immediately said, look, can we do a slope map? You know, like they did in the lowest plateau in China, where they defined landscape by the degrees of slope, and you can color the map by degrees of slope. And he said, what slopes do you need? And I said, well, like from 0 to 2 degrees is almost flat, so give me that. And from 2 to 4 is where it's pretty well stable, but a little bit of erosion control helps if you're growing crops. Trees would be fine, but then from 4 to 8 is where you can grow trees with erosion control, you know, and from 8 to 12 degrees and from 12 to 18 degrees, and there you pull up.
Yeah.
Because from 18 on, it should be permanently stable in biosphere reserve or permanent forest untouched. And we produced it. And I immediately could see this translates the landscape to the uninitiated. Like, this is like a translation service. With Ben's ability to manipulate the map to be easy to see, like all the buildings are highlighted, the fence lines accentuated, everything you need about the design is brought up so you can see it. And the contours, I mean, they're accurate. Within 2 inches, horizontal and vertical, you've got, it's a missile coordinate, actually, militarily or mining site-wise. This is where the technology is really used.
Yeah,
military, you know, targeting and LiDAR has been used by the fracking companies and mapping and mining companies and et cetera. So it's an ill wind that doesn't blow somebody some good. And I could just see that, wow, I could translate this.
And just so I'm clear, what you're saying is, like, I've got a normal contour map I'm looking at. I got two contours, and I know the elevation of both of them. But what you're saying is we can color code the slope degrees between them? Is that what you're basically saying? Wow.
Well, we can go right down to a three-inch contour.
Holy crap. We can see,
if you leave a shovel in the paddock, we can see it on the contour map. It's kind of like that. You can see the curbs on the edge of the road. You can see anything. In fact, you can get too much data.
More like a high-end fish finder that I have on my boat than what people are like. I can literally see the contour.
Top of the line.
Wow.
The top of the line by a long way. So it's got better since we've been working. So, you know, now we can see the underground aquifers. We can see into the ground. We can see through the forest. So LiDAR doesn't get stopped by the trees.
Okay. And
now we have a wet and dry map. We have an aspect map. We have about 8 different maps that we can give you in a set of layers, all fit together in the scale. So your ability to map is up, but your ability to design is right up. But your client can understand what you're saying. It translates what we say in permaculture to someone who doesn't know any better, right? They just don't know. I had a client with 100 acres in the Georgia mountains. I can do this all over the world now. I don't have to leave Australia to design. And in fact, if he shipped me to America to do a design, I'll still want a LiDAR map if I can. I still want a bend map because I can see everything without walking around and I can check it. So I have a client bought 100 acres in Georgia and it's great, right? You look on the map, you can see it's got quite a lot of dark green, which is in our slope map. So it's almost flat. There's lovely areas of flat. So it should be good. Okay. Then lay the aspect map over it. And they're all in the shade.
Wow.
So you just bought a property with lovely flat ground, but with no sunlight on the flat ground. So it's not what you thought.
The sun's on the slope and the shade's on the flat.
Yeah. So you, in a cold climate, you need sun exposure. But in a tropical or a hot desert, you need shade. You've got to know what you need, right? But this map, these maps laying on top of each other, there's also a ruggedness map. So ruggedness shows you if it's all covered in rocks, it's all covered in slips, irregularities. Now, not all the world has automatic LiDAR. And some parts of the world, like where I work in Hungary, I have a big project in Hungary, you have to pay the government to release it. Other places, there's privacy. In the Middle East, there's privacy. Right? And because of the Islamic culture, they don't allow, you know, satellite maps going straight down over gardens with raised walls and privacy issues. But we're never going to get the Middle East. But then just in the last 2 years, everything keeps changing. In the last 2 years, they made it legal. And there are companies that you can consult with that allow you to get the permission to do a LiDAR map. And then companies that fly a drone over with a LiDAR camera.
Okay.
Now, when I started 8 years ago on this, I mean, I was so excited. I realized the potential. But I had to pioneer how to sell it to my clients because you still got to pay $1,000 or $2,000 for a map. But that map is so valuable. And now I've learned to sell it and explain it and give examples. But in the middle, at that time, a LiDAR camera was $250,000.
Oh, wow.
Now it's 25,000.
And this is being done by drone then? Because I had a question on that from the audience here. Is it LiDAR imaging or satellite?
It's both.
Okay.
So I'm doing a very large job in Saudi Arabia right now. It's about 1,000 acres of organic dates, and they're running out of water. So I've got to rehydrate the landscape. So that you can't get a satellite image out of Saudi. The government's probably got it. The military's got it, but they're not giving it away. But you can get permission to fly a drone. Now, when a property is 1,000 acres, you don't lift that drone camera with a quadricopter. Like, it's like an agricultural drone.
right? Yeah.
Like a quadricopter, because that's for a smaller block of land.
Yeah, yeah, that's a huge piece.
Like 1,000 acres, it's a little airplane. Looks like a military drone. It's a little airplane, right? So that lifts the LiDAR camera and gets the imagery you need. Then you need someone to translate it into what can then be manipulated by Ben. Or Ben can tell you, and we need more Bens, so we need to teach people how to do what Ben does and why I've got this giant screen behind the laptop here is because I want to translate to people how I use LiDAR to design.
Got you.
I've had students on my online course in the last few years say, look, I did music at university, and they took us, they got us to listen to a symphony, and they broke it down to which instrument starts playing first and how the instruments combine and how the symphony is constructed, music set by music set, instrument by instrument. Can't you do that with the way you produce designs? And I can, but it's very hard just talking it through.
Yeah.
Imagery, if I show you on this image, now we use Affinity as a mapping program. You could use AutoCAD or any of the others, but Affinity is really quite a little bit more photogenic. It's photo real. So I've created a banana brush, a banana circle brush, a date palm brush. You can do that on Affinity. So I can literally, I've got a solar panel brush. It's kind of weird, right? But you can, it's not like painting normally, it's photorealism. So I have another student say to me, look, I went to art, I did fine art at university, and the professors took me in and took us into the art museum and said, this is a Picasso or something, you know, this is a famous painting. And this is how it was painted. They did the undercoat, they did the next layer, they then brought in these scratches. They picked the whole classic painting apart and told us how it was painted. Can't you do that? This is in the same time. So there's kind of realizations happening. As I've released this, they've said, we love it, but can you just pull it apart and show us why you chose a swale there, why you chose a forest there, what made you do this? So I'm thinking, and Ben advised me, well, why don't you get a giant whiteboard, an interactive whiteboard that, like they use in universities and high schools now, and you can stand in front of it and show the image being created. So that's what I'm working on. I'm working on how I take the LiDAR maps that Ben makes user-friendly for me and my clients. It has to be user-friendly for me and my clients, otherwise it's useless, right? I have to translate what it is to my clients. But to other people that want to do this, I've got to stand in front of that board and teach it. This is why I make these decisions. Now, because I can change these layers, say, there's the aspect, it's in the sun, or it's not. There's the flow map. I've got animations for water.
It's taking what we learn in a PDC to another level, where we do these aspect overlay maps with tracing paper and multi-layer, but you're actually doing it in a way that brings it to life, which is really good, because a lot of things that I know, and I'm a pretty good teacher, I have a hard time getting the student to understand, if you know what I mean. Like, I know exactly what I'm saying, and why did you put a swale there? Like you said, it is on a relatively small property, and it's right there. You can look at it. And I'm like, because that's where the land said it goes.
Yeah.
But sometimes they don't understand what you – and it's hard to explain what that means. It's like by the time they understand when you say it, you've already taught them how to do it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, the better you get, you kind of automatically almost see it. This is the tyranny of being an expert. How do you bring it back to teach it at a simple level? But the amount of words that can be misconceived or not translated right. But we're so visual now. We look at phones all day. I mean, everybody's like 60 hours on a screen. When you put it on a screen, and they can copy, they can take that, they can take that screen image. They can replay the video. I mean, that's why I think all our video teaching has gone so well. So it's taking the maps into the, and there's new layers coming. There's, if you look at the Grace data, if everybody, grace was almost secret, and suddenly they released grace, G-R-A-C-E, which is where the LIDAR data goes underground. We can see the depletion of the aquifers. We can see the recharge of the aquifers. So, because grace has only been open to the public a few years now, and it was amazing when it came out, we can see the recharge of swales. We can see the land rehydrating with our swales. So we're proving that we're rehydrating. We're proving we're recharging aquifers. There's lots of bad data out there about, you know, the Ocala aquifer and the different aquifers being depleted, and how Saudi tried to grow all its own wheat with center pivot irrigation and started to drop the Nile aquifer away. And then they stopped and it started to recharge on its own. But we can prove that we can speed that up. So we're talking big consequences here. It's been an interesting journey for me, and it's been interesting how to translate it to people. But I have enough examples now. I have hundreds of maps now that I've done with LIDAR, and you can actually see the evolution of my design over the last few years. And in the very last, 2 years, like last year and a bit, I have been learning to use Affinity, which is the mapping program. I don't normally need to do that. I've got people that can do it, but I've had to learn, and I'm 71, right? So like, it's not my gig. It's not what I do. Yeah. I'm not a guy, right? But I've had to bite the bullet, and I'm a very slow learner, but once I get it, I've got it. So I can now use Affinity. Now, I have some young students who are rock. They're jet pilots on it. They're so much quicker than me. They're so much quicker. But for me to teach it, I have to learn it. And that's been difficult, but I'm there. People have been very patient with me because they wanted the translation of my design ability into Affinity so I can train people. So that's, you know, I've always been a bit of a fire lighter, and I've taken on risks and gone into new ways of teaching and designing. And I've been criticized for it and in the permaculture movement, some of my work, but I've usually been copied. My first online course, people were not keen about teaching online, but now everybody's online teaching. And so it goes. I keep improving my online course. And now, at last, I'm going to release an evergreen. It's nearly about to be released. So they'll, instead of a course that's supported by 12 teacher's assistants and loads of extra data, and it's an event, it starts and it finishes, and you have like 1,000 or 2,000 students with you from all over the world going through the event, and there are different lectures every week being released, and it's enormous amount of extra learning exercises and different information. There's 35,000 questions answered every course, and just massive amounts of graphics and extra information. Huge. I've now just about released an evergreen where you just buy it and you get it all in one lump, and it's cheap. It's much cheaper. You don't get supported much, a little bit. Yeah. But what we've developed, and it's not me, remember it's my team, is a Jeff Lawton AI.
Huh. I was about to ask you about AI. I wanted to go there next because it's changed so much of what I do. I jumped on board with it almost immediately, using mostly the LLMs like GPT and Gemini and what have you. And my audience was very, very resistant to it. It's the devil. It's going to take over the world. It's going to kill John Connor, whatever they could come up with. And it was really like anything they could do to shield themselves from this new technology needing to be utilized. And I've developed a lot of material with it, permaculture material and other things that I teach, that I could have done it without it, but I can move so much faster with it. What are you guys doing? You're building a robo, Jeff?
Well, yeah. Well, very early on, my team, now it's got a big team on the online course, and they're all technical. I don't do it, but they do, and they analyze quite quickly the questions we've been asked. And they realized I'd answered 6,000 questions. Oh, no, sorry. I'd answered 6,000 pages of questions.
Oh, geez.
When they added them all up, and then they found, like, what's the most commonly asked question? What's the most asked question? What's the second most asked question? All the way down the hit list. Thousands of questions.
The number one question, what about mosquitoes in the swales, right?
Or generally, what about mosquitoes is number one question. Yeah. Second is contour.
Okay.
Which is weird. I mean, like, how disconnected are we?
Yeah.
So anyway, and they put an algorithm over it so we could auto answer within the course and see the selection of ways it's been answered. Well, they put that into an AI. They put every question I'd ever answered into an AI. So it's just a specialist AI that answers with my previous answers. So you ask a question into the Jeff Lawton AI during the course, it tells you what I've answered it before. And they got me to test it. They said, ask the most difficult question you could ever imagine. Try and ask the most difficult questions. And I'm really asking myself the question, aren't I? I mean, it's going to answer with something I've said before. And it was an interesting exercise. I was kind of surprised what it came back with. And it was something I'd previously said, but it put it together they put multiple answers together in a really nice format. And so this is good. And I'm talking to myself, aren't I? I asked a very difficult question about windbreaks and the height and distance between windbreaks on a flat landscape and what the density should be to slow it down so you don't get an equine spiral on the other side. And like, how would I calculate the height and density of the tree belt and how far apart would they be? And it's like, that's not an easy question to answer. I mean, it's not. But it came up with this really nice, rational answer. It's like, wow, I sound good. It's weird. Yeah. And anyway, that's again about to be released with the Evergreen. So
awesome. You get
that's a backup. And there will be some support, but it's a much smaller course in information availability because our team answer enormous amounts of questions and we have lots of learning exercises and beautiful, beautiful graphics. We're always improving our graphics because we have lots of cameramen involved, you know, so you can always get sort of improvement. And I just keep filming. I mean, I have one day a week, and it's usually today, actually, that I have a cameraman here. But I didn't have the cameraman because I was going to talk to you.
Okay.
And also, I was going to talk about my we are trying, and I noticed you're using the same system that we're trying to use when you got me to sign up here.
Mm-hmm.
StreamYard. Ben wanted to use OBS, but I couldn't do it. I might be able to later. So we've started a podcast which haven't released yet. We've filmed 3 episodes, and it's a 4-way podcast with it's myself, Ben Missima, Eric Sider from Sacramento, who's working on the permaculture group startup kit, which we have now, that anywhere in the world can start a permaculture group in a local government area, we recommend. And then Sam Parker Davis, who's here at Zaytuna Farm, who's only 27, he's been with me 8 years, and he's now my brother-in-law. He's worked in Iraq. He's worked in the most difficult situations. He's followed my model. I've like mentored him. And he's the young voice, and he's very, very good with his words. So you've got this young guy, me as the old guy, Ben as the mapping guy, and Eric, who's worked with me for 20 years and many different locations, who's very much a second American voice, because Ben kind of sounds Southern States, kind of American style, to me or to a lot of non-American audience possibly. And then Eric, who's kind of originally New York State, Eastern, and a great sense of humor. I mean, I love Eric's sense of humor. So we've got a 4-way screen, and we're talking about a particular subject each podcast. So at the moment, it's not invitations to interview. It's more the 4 of us talking about a particular subject. Like we were going to talk the next one about glyphosate and permaculture as just to open up a can of worms there.
That'll do.
Yeah. And we talked about water harvesting. And we actually did a last podcast was about Iran, because I've worked in Iran. And I the whole of Iran became organic from one compost heap I made. I have all that reference material. I have all that data. I have all that, you know, production models. They've sent me lots of stuff. Over 17 years ago, I worked in Iran, in working for the United Nations FAO program, and I taught a PDC. And it's sort of a subject people probably went, well, I'm not sure I want to hear any good news from that country, but I have a lot of information. So prior to that episode that we were filming, I contacted my students in Iran, and they got back to me, and we talked about a lot of stuff. But I have slideshows on their results. Every single crop, every single fruit tree, has been trialed and converted to organic through a composting program that is extensive. They've even made swale making machines. They've made their own. Prior to Caterpillar, they've gone in front of the Caterpillar game, you know, like Caterpillar should catch up here. They've made swale making machines that apply compost right behind the swale as it's made.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and the results are phenomenal. And I would say they're improving. And we talked about things like, you know, do you realize they're still making canats? Most people don't even know what a canat is, but. And most of us think they're ancient, but underground canals that run water from the mountains out to the flat country and run forever once you start them up, they still have tradesmen. You can hire a canal construction company in Iran to put one in for you.
It's basically a pipeline without a pipe, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's an underground canal coming from high up in the mountains where they hook into a deep spring line and they have to find them first, and then they fall slowly downhill and come out on the plain. So you end up with a continuous flow of water out in a dry land landscape. And once you start them up, you can't stop them unless you're going to like shut it, like collapse it.
Yeah.
And there are canats I've documented in films I did in Oman and other places where they've been running up to 4,000 years. I've seen canats that have been running 4,000, many 2,000. Only way you can stop them is to like bomb it or dynamite it and collapse the underground canal. And if you look on Google Earth or any of those systems, you can see donuts in a straight line. They look like donuts. Okay. There where they're bringing the material out of a shaft, and then it goes so far and they start another shaft. Anyway, viewers can look that up. But the thing is, I still use Google Earth because I can fly in and I can look at stuff. But the truth is, Google Earth contours, you know, Google Earth is not accurate. If you want to do, a whole country, or if you want to do all of Texas, right, Google Earth wouldn't be too bad.
Yeah.
But if you come in close with Google Earth, try to do a small area, it can be like 60 feet, 100 feet out. Right? And when you're using the LiDAR, you're coming into like 2 inches.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's kind of like a sales forecast. I can do a much better sales forecast over a year than over a week. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of Google Earth is like that blunt instrument, where LiDAR is what it looks like now. Because also a lot of the data that you can gain, it might have been right in 1998 when it was measured the last time, but things change. We have major erosion events. I'm sure you've heard about the flooding in South Texas. I'm sure some topography has been changed.
Yeah.
Right? And along with lives lost, you know, like topography has changed. When you have a river rise 26 feet in 45 minutes, it's going to change the landscape. And you need to be aware of that. And the thing is, like, that is – you can't prevent that completely, but situations like that can be mitigated by some of the earthworks that we're talking about doing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Tree systems on after earthworks established. Once you're up, you've got a shock absorber. You definitely can build a biological shock absorber. But, contour map generators as well are nowhere near LiDAR. It's much, much, so... they're useful. One thing I like about Google Earth is that I can press the clock in the toolbar and see history going backwards. Now, the more people click on a site, the more the Google bot photographs it. That's a trick. You can con the Google bot to think it's a popular site.
Ah.
So all sites that get regular clicks get more photos by the Google bot photography. You know? And now you have Street View. I've been doing a job in the Philippines, and the Street View is fantastic. I can go in Street View and go down the road where the job is in this little village in the Philippines, and I can turn around with Street View and see, oh, they've got moringa. Oh, they've got, you know, mangoes. I can see most of the trees. I'm literally in the street where I'm designing. So there are lots of things that are good about Google Earth, but if we want to say from the other side of the planet, I can design your earthworks within 2 inches of accuracy, which is fine with a bulldozer.
Mm-hmm.
2 inches will do.
You ain't gonna be able to. That's we call margin of error in shooting. Like the if the rifle can shoot a 1-inch group, it's within a margin of error of the shooter. Like it's not gonna make the difference. It was a 1/2 inch more accurate because if the shooter can do their job, it's within that margin of error. And 2 inches is the margin of error of a bulldozer for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can get geological maps over the top as well, so you get a rough idea of the geology, but once you get in the ground, you can always find something unusual, and the earth mover then has to change things on the job. I've actually got old aerial photographs of Zaytuna Farm here in 1943. The first aerial photographs were shot over this property in 1943. It was part of the war effort, but it was a plane with a glass lens. I can get it from the National Archives, pay for it. Eventually you can track the plane that went over your area, and that goes over the top, but it's distorted.
Mm.
It's not a satellite photo. So what we had to do was find 10 points that were the same in 1943 and stretch the old photo to fit the satellite image. But still interesting to see, oh, wow, look at the landscape. There wasn't many trees on this property in 1943. They'd all been logged out. It was interesting to see the trees that were here in 1943 and then go and find them.
Mm.
Wow, you were a reasonable tree in 1943. Look at you now.
Oh, wow.
So wow. I was like, wow, look at this. And then there were fields and things that were like, they're not here now.
Yeah.
There was a field and a cultivated bit of land. And so, you know, we're information detectives. So we can, you know, speed up succession. So we're really accelerating succession into stability and useful landscapes. I'm just trying to get it so we can be appreciated and cover some distance. I've got some pretty big jobs coming up. They're pretty large, and people are realizing the benefits. Saudi Arabia and COP13, which was in Rio, the MBS, the Mohammed bin Salman, kind of the ruler of Saudi, he announced they wanted to plant 10 billion trees before 2030. That's B, billion, right? That's
billions,
more.
Right? Billions with a B. That's
a lot of trees.
I said to you earlier when we were chatting before we got on the air, like 10 billion worms is a lot of worms. Right, let alone 10 billion. 10 billion bacteria is a lot of bacteria. 10 billion trees, that's changing the quotient of biomass on the planet in a positive way. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, and of course, that's easier to say, but then when to do it, how to do it, well, you've definitely got to choose the right trees. And in a landscape like that, they only get 3 inches of rain a year and high temperatures, and you need excellent mapping. You need a bit of earthworks for sure to make water harvesting a bit easier, and you need to plant them exactly at the right time, exactly in the right way. If you make one little bit of mistake, you just got a death field.
Yeah.
And there was some of the tree planting companies, luckily one contacted us that's very much a permaculture supporter, and then shipped Ben and I into Dammam in Saudi to explain how we would go about it. But there's also got massive waste fields. Like there's huge feedlots, dairy feedlots, with like 3 or 4 miles of green waste stream coming out of weeds and green across the desert, not being directed into large tree planting systems. We can spread that water and that nutrient.
Of a project you did a while ago where they were swales, but it was really like these long straight canals that you intercepted outflow of irrigation from another growing system, except on a much bigger scale.
Yeah, it's well, that's some of the things they saw and contacted us, because that was just the back pressure off a center pivot. And we could, well, there's an advantage here because we've got, 150,000, gallons of water a day coming across this landscape doing nothing. And we can do something with it. And waste product from industry is often just channeled towards the ocean or channeled away, not really doing anything in particular. So those are some of our first projects. Some are just going to be rain fed. But the species, you have to really be careful about the species, and you have to have trees at the right stage of growth. It's not large trees. Large trees look good when you plant them. They don't look good when they're all dead,
Yeah.
You keep the irrigation up. So some of our tree planting contractors are paid over 5 years. So you get paid every year the tree's still alive, paid to plant it, paid in a year's time if it's still alive, and another payment at 2, 3, 4, and 5 years. At 5 years, we should be pretty well away.
Yeah.
And everything in those landscapes are an anti-evaporation strategy. Once you've greatly reduced the evaporation, you've also gained condensation drip, you have a big advantage, And then maybe you can bring in slightly more sophisticated trees, but your first trees are rugged frontliners. They're really rugged. And that's something we've learned working in the Dead Sea Valley and other parts.
Usually something with thorns.
Usually something with thorns, yeah. And the stage where you get out of the thorny species into non-thorny species is a lovely stage. But we've done a lot of work through Jordan and surrounding areas. Now we've got quite a lot of experience in that stuff. And now we have better chippers. There's now 10-blade chippers that do date palms and palm fronds and bamboo and banana. There are chippers where you can feed a whole banana tree straight in, or a fresh big bamboo culm, or you can all your oil palms, all your coconut palms, all your date palms. Now they can all be chipped, and now you have all the great compost turners, that we put in. The technology's come good, and we have forage harvesters now that are fantastic. So there's a suite of equipment that makes soil creation a sort of set unit. So we ship that into projects now. So, this is the kit you need, and you have the chipper, you have the turner, right? You have manure sources, you have thermometers, you have microscopes, you have compost tea brewing, you have applicators, and you can grow compost crops. You can grow the herbaceous crops for the green material, but you can grow trees that you regularly cut and put through the composting chipper to the compost turner. But then you can feed some of your compost tea back to the feed line. So you're upcycling your compost growing system. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take much, less than a tenth of a farm can grow its own fertilizer. That is a life replication system. It's improving itself because you're feeding back. Some of your fertilizer goes back to what grows the fertilizer kind of thing. So that's been a move towards, some of our compromise with agriculture. I don't like compromising with agriculture. I think it needs to be completely redesigned and repatterned. But it is what it is right now. And if we improve it and get the thinking back in that direction, things might change.
That's the challenge for the designer, is to work with what is rather than what you wish was there, right? I mean, like, some of the stuff you're saying is making me think about, like, how many opportunities like this are there? How many places do we have something going on, whether it's agriculture or something else, and there's this affluent of water that's probably nasty, going somewhere and doing something it shouldn't do, and there's some way to intercept that, to clean it, and to turn it into an asset. I mean, I have a tiny little place here. I keep about 100 ducks on the property. But even with that, I have this system where the ducks go home at night and they crap in this tank, and then I open the tank up and the tank runs into – it's a small. It's like an 8x16 pond. The pond is completely covered in the summer with water hyacinths. The water that comes out the pond is cleaner than the water that comes out of my sink by the time the water hyacinth gets done with it. And then the water hyacinth goes into the compost pit, and the ducks eat the water hyacinth. And then that's the seed compost for the annual production of bioreactor compost, right? And that's like one redneck on a 3-acre farm in Texas. If we can take those types of things and we can expand them to kind of the industrial scale, I don't want to say industrial level, but the industrial scale, the amount of difference that could be made. And then you start looking at these places like a dairy lot differently. Mm-hmm. Now it's not, it's a blight. It is what it is. I'd like it to go away and change into something else, but it is what it is. But now at least I can take this waste product and do more with it for good than most people would ever see. And there's so many opportunities like that. And this little system I have, that was actually a fairly large project done up in Canada where they had Muscovy ducks were being raised in an industrial farm egg operation. And they had these lagoons because they had, you know, thousands of ducks, and they had all this effluent they had to deal with. And I figured out that since the ducks pretty much lay in the summer and spring up there, that that's when it was warm enough to grow this plant, which is illegal where I grow it, but whatever. And did it work? And as soon as I read that, I'm like, oh, I can build that right here. And if we could just get people to move at that speed and experiment, try things.
Well, you're the essential.
You know what eats water hyacinth, Jeff? Everything we eat. Every animal we eat eats water hyacinth. And ducks are the only animal I found anyway that don't just eat the top, they eat the roots. And they plow into the roots first because the roots are always full of snails.
A lot of azolla.
Oh, they love that too, yes.
But all of the floating water plants, it's really everything we call an enemy is actually something we should be using as a friend.
Correct.
But I love that scale. Your scale is the scale that's most important because that's where we produce most quality and most production per meter. But when you go up, like these systems in Saudi, the first thing we said was you need reed bed. And there are industrial reed beds out there. John Todd Living Machines was the pioneer in Vermont, but they're everywhere now. And you know where the largest reed beds are in the world? I'm an edge thinker, so I like to know where the largest is and what the smallest you can do something, but at extremities. The largest reed beds in the world are in the oil fields of Oman.
Okay.
So the country of Oman is quite alternative. It's kind of different. It's got many government policies that are quite different to the rest of the Middle East. And that's where you get those old Kanat systems. You might have seen the video where I walked down a 25-kilometer food forest. It's like, what? But there you have the largest oil, the largest reed beds in the world, and it's to clean up their oil waste. And, like, that's right, you know, like, that's not far from Saudi. That's next door. It borders it. And like, what are we doing? Like, why aren't we just taking – And what you know what's driven this in Saudi is carbon credits. The trees that we're planting are going to give these industrial systems and government regional areas a carbon credit, which is really like, I don't know about carbon credits, like we're going to tax carbon or whatever. But at least they've got an initiative to do reforestation. If that's what drives it, I don't really care anymore. But
yeah,
like,
that's kind of where I am. Like that, there's a lot of that going on with biochar too, that like – Microsoft has a bid out right now to buy more biochar than exists. They have no real legitimate use for it, but if they buy it and they give it to farmers, they get the credit. So even if I think the government policy or whatever is dumb, if you can bend it to get a positive result, this is back to, you know, your thing about the more restrictions on a design, the more eloquent the design. If the designer is good at his task. So these governmental things, these are restrictions. And they're, you know, one level off moving a mountain. They're very hard to change. But they can be harnessed. And when we harness things, then we can produce positive things, even from things that are negative, like a feedlot, affluent flow. Like you could actually turn that into an asset. A government policy that taxes the air you exhale, you can still turn that into something positive if you channel it properly. Yeah. So I call it status jujitsu.
Yeah. I mean, the LA River, which is the largest concrete drain in the world, exits more water than is brought into LA that is not drunk. So from the Rio Grande dams, this massive channel, I think it's like 55% of the water that comes into LA is not drunk. It's not consumed by people. It's used for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more than that goes down the LA drain as wastewater, the LA River as a drain. Like, I mean, Fred Pierce documents that in the book, When the Rivers Run Dry. It's just like, we're supposed to be quite clever at stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just basic maths.
We don't have enough water. Get away, water. I mean, it's very hard to understand. Like the number of underground cisterns alone that LA, with all the money they spend, could have put in over the last 50 years, and then divert that water into those cisterns, and then your evaporation is, well, it's pretty much nothing because it's underground. Mm. Funny thing, Jeff, when you put stone over top of water, it doesn't really evaporate much anymore.
Yes.
It's crazy. You know, like that's and you look at that and go, how do we have all these civil engineers paid all this money? And I actually think many of them do think this way, but they are in a finitely limited system that prevents that creativity and that artistry from coming out. But I mean, what gives me hope is people like you, people like Alan Booker and the work he's doing. He's training civil engineers. Right. He's training those guys. He's going inside the belly of the beast to infect them with this knowledge and hopefully get more things like this done.
Well, my son studied environmental management and civil engineering at university because of this thought. And I think many young people are doing the same thing. Right? And he's now dry hiring machines all over the world, putting in great earthworks because of that understanding. But I think you are getting a change. Generally, civil engineers, they don't need any extra work. They've got plenty of work. They don't need to do something interesting or thoughtful. They're just slamming great big things together. But really, a forward-thinking government, I mean, does that actually exist? But, like, it should subsidize this work. And there would be a way to calculate how much it should be subsidized for its result. It's like architects should be paid more the less energy a house uses and the less embodied energy there is over its lifetime of the product the house is built out of. It's a pretty easy calculation, but we don't pay architects that way. We pay them to create follies of strange architecture that's supposed to be artistic and doesn't necessarily function. You know, buildings should have functionality where they harvest their own energy, they harvest their own water, they heat and cool themselves. That's how we should pay people. And it's the same with land, you know, town planners and civil engineers. It's the you know, the functionality of the civil engineering and the embodied energy over its lifetime. When we put in poor engineering, it falls apart and needs heavy maintenance.
I think a lot of it, this is kind of outside the realm of permaculture, but a lot of it has to do with the monetary system and, you know, the U.S., so goes the U.S. with the monetary system for the last 150 years, so goes the world. And in 71, when we closed the gold window, we went to a pure fiat system. I feel like we got fiat everything else. We got fiat farming. We got fiat food. We got fiat buildings. We got fiat roads. We got fiat bridges. Like everything is just, well, just throw more money at it and build more of it. If we need more energy, just produce more energy. There's never a thought of conservation, right? Unless it's so that they can come up with a way to tax somebody. But it's not like you said, like, okay, if we're going to build this building, why don't we build this building to last 1,000 years and use as little energy as possible during its lifetime?
Yeah. So
literally no one even thinks that way because in a fiat society, you're thinking, well, 1,000 years, it's not my problem. Hell, my problem ends in 50. Right. And my real problem of getting reelected ends in another 20. So all I care about is now. and we're not thinking in that seven generation model forward anymore. And we haven't been globally for a very, very long time. And I do think we're starting to see some level of a shift in that. And it is, you know, the young people get a lot of crap, but it is those kids, I think, that hopefully old guys like you and me, we're infecting them with this mentality, because if somebody doesn't do this, we're going to get more of what we have, and that's not what we want.
I was teaching a PDC in southern Yemen in Hadramaut. Hadramaut Valley is like the second largest of the Grand Canyon. It looks like the Grand Canyon. They have the tallest mud brick buildings in the world in a town there called Shabam. They're 8 stories on average. There's a couple there that are 11 stories. But I was in a village nearby, and most people are in mud brick houses. And they're the mud brick masons of the world, the southern Yemenis, not the northern Yemenis, not the Houthis, but the southern Yemenis. And I was talking about sustainability in housing and how long, you know, we should make things last. And the student put his hand up and said, my family's lived in the same house for 1,000 years. And I was shocked. I went, wow, never heard of that. Half the class put their hand up and said, so's our family. And there were buildings that are 2,000 years old. And Shabam's a nickname. If you want to look it up, look up Manhattan of the Desert. Right, you'll see Shabam, very famous, that one town. I went through there and I got a tour of some of the really tall buildings. And the UNESCO wanted to save Shabam. And this leads back to what you're saying, actually. We'll get back to the debt system. And the people in the Shabam said, go away. Go and save yourself. You need saving. And they said, what are you talking about? They said, you know, the buildings are 2,000 years old and, you know, like, we need to save them. They said, they're fine. You don't need to save our buildings. And they said, why? And they said, well, there's nothing wrong with them. We maintain them all the time. We've got our own lime and our own mud and we keep plastering. They're not, nothing's happening. They said, why do you think that is? And they said, it's simple. We build them ourselves out of raw materials. We didn't have to pay for it. We can still maintain them with the same materials, and we didn't build them with debt. We didn't go into debt to do this. And you need to learn from us. We don't have anything to learn from you. We are living in those buildings. They're 2,000 years old. Go away and save yourself. It's like, wow. I mean, that's very tribal Yemen, in southern Yemen. And it is still a peaceful area. It is a, you know, safe area. I wouldn't, you know, it's difficult getting into Yemen right now, of course. But shocking. I mean, people don't even know about this stuff. They don't even know. I mean, they have some long drop compost toilets that are 6 stories high. You're taking a dump down a 6-story shaft. And some of those are 1,000 years old. And Bill Gates wants to make a sustainable toilet. I mean, there are old castles in Europe that have the same, actually, this old stuff, right? You know, like, we can deal with our waste. It's not that offensive. We can decentralize our systems. I mean, your duct system on 3 acres, no wonder you haven't got any weeds. I mean, the cycles of nutrient that you're capturing in carbon sponges, which are really fast carbon pathways delivered by the sun for free, you've just put the right things in position that you've got an enormous sponge to spread out the nutrient. Of course, there's no room for weeds. Weeds have no place. There's nothing to repair. You don't have a headache. You don't need any damn aspirin. I mean, It's like, you know, but the conventional pharmaceutical system says you've got a headache, you've got to take aspirin. Your body has a deficiency of aspirin. There's no need for
that. That's when you say that. That's how I explain alternative medicine all the time. Like, if you're just doing replacement therapy, you're not getting it. Like, a headache is neither a deficiency in aspirin or white willow bark. There's a reason you have a headache. You need to address the reason. And I'm not a prude on that. I'm not opposed to using aspirin or willow bark for the headache, but you better also understand the underlying reason for the headache. If it's a stress headache, why are you stressed?
What's the cause? Don't keep treating the symptom. And that's what we do with weeds all the time. And invasive species, like invasive medics, you know, like, what? There's symptoms. What's the cause? What is the cause? like, you know, the wilderness was depleted in your area. It had lots of natural assemblies of interactive diversity that held a certain fertility together. And we can emulate that into our, towards our convenience. Probably Muscovy ducks weren't there. It doesn't matter that they are there now. It doesn't matter that it's got fruit trees that come from around. None of that matters, because the amount of space that we need to provide our needs is minuscule to what we're presently using. Our systems are highly inefficient per area, you know. So, yeah, it's just getting those realizations across. And if we have to use a whiteboard, interactive whiteboard, and use technology, I don't care. I don't care right now, because technology is just slamming everything anyway. I mean, look at the technology that's being thrown around the Middle East right now. It's crazy. And like, what's happening with your farms? What is happening with people locking up all the farm workers now? I'm hearing crazy things about the American agriculture.
I'll tell you right now, Jeff, be careful with what you believe about that, because most of the farm, most, I'm talking like 95% of the farm workers that are migrant farm workers in America come in a completely different program. It's completely legal. The government literally has buildings for them to check in and check out at. So this stuff you're being told about, they're rounding up the people picking lettuce and shipping them out, I can at least report some good news. That's 100% bullshit. That is just not happening. That is not a thing. That is the media lying to you, because we have migrant farm worker program for those people that want to do that work. That is not you know, the stuff that's going on like in the streets of LA and all, hey, love it or hate it, doesn't matter. Those are not the people picking your crops. They don't grow them in downtown LA. They grow them in the agricultural country. So that's a lie. That's just not happening.
That's it. That's sort of brought up a subject that I wanted to thought about. I should touch with you. Not sure. I've seen the world get better and better and worse and worse.
Yep,
since agreed. I've been involved. But I've just realized I've seen the media get more truthful and more bullshit. Like, we're getting false news, false media, and we're getting truthful media from the general public with phones.
Yep.
I mean, look what's happening. I'm very close to Gaza where I live. My wife's Palestinian, right? I have a Palestinian family in the Middle East. And, you know, it's very disturbing. But that's all been exposed with people, brave people with phones, right? This is real. And then we're told absolute crap, right?
Yeah.
I've been watching YouTube of stuff going on, sort of trying to judge what's real, what's not real. And we've been told stuff, and I'm talking to people on the ground in Jordan. We're in the Dead Sea Valley. I'm looking at Jerusalem on the top of the hill. Jericho's right in front of us. I can just about see cars in Jericho. If I had binoculars, I could see the people in the cars. We're that close to the West Bank. We see the missiles coming right over.
Sure.
I mean, it looks like giant fireworks, and you get the interceptors and the whole thing thumping and banging, and we're in debris. People are getting undercover because of the, like, shrapnel coming down.
Yeah.
I'm phoning people, and they're saying, they're telling us it's happening now. And they say, no, it's not happening now. There's no missiles going over us.
Yeah.
They're saying they're going, no. Okay. Anybody seeing them in the north? No. Oh, now they're going over. Now they're not saying we're going over. What? I'm getting real reports from the ground. I mean, they got their my PA.
Yeah.
Right, is Darren Hayes from Western Australia, another ex-military. A lot of my guys are ex-military because they're good, right? They've got a task completion attitude. Often they get shit done. They've often had a serious injury or health issue that's changed their attitude to their future, and they've come into permaculture as like hard workers. So Darren says he's been with me 8 years. He's living on the Green in the Desert project. He knows military stuff. I'm saying, well, what is happening? Well, that's not happening. This is happening. And it's like, what are we getting told? Like, and he's got the phone app. So when there's the missile, see him? You've got the phone. I'm sure. And this is live data. That's not bullshitted somewhere. It's like, we're getting told one thing and then another thing. I noticed a few years ago, that, you know, I was working in Iraq, and like I'm right on the front line in northern Iraq building straw bale houses, a crazy thing I'm doing. Villages have been destroyed. An aid organization wanted me to go in and build straw bale houses. They got massive amounts of straw in northern Iraq, so it was easy to get the material. And but I'd been moving from one aid project to another, with just this, and it was pre-internet, not quite the internet we've got now, and the mobile phones. So I was watching television, and I'm watching ABC News and CNN because that's all I could get. So I wanted to know if, like, things were collapsing around me because I didn't have any other way to know. There was a little bit of internet, right? Hotmail was just starting up, kind of thing.
Okay.
I was also in Macedonia during the Kosovo crisis. I've been on some front lines, and the only thing I watched was CNN News then and BBC World. The startup drum roll to BBC World will always haunt me for my whole life, right? Because I was wondering what the hell the news was coming next. But then I'd fly to South America or I'd fly to Europe to do a job and back. And then within a few hours, I'd be in another country, another part of the world, and I'd put on CNN and I'd put on BBC World, and it's different news. It's not the same news.
Yes.
Where in the Middle East, I'd see the same newsreel going through, and then every now and again, every few days or a day, it would change. It's the same newsreel going, rolling around. I go to Europe, I go to South America, there's a newsreel, but it's not the same damn newsreel.
Yeah.
And I think, well, they give different people different. That was way back. I mean, we're talking 20 plus years ago.
Yeah. Are you familiar with this term, Jeff? Gelman amnesia.
Gelman?
Gelman amnesia, right there in the screen. Okay. I love this because I don't get to teach Jeff Lawton things very often. I'm usually learning. Okay, Gelman amnesia is a term that was coined by Michael Crichton. He's the guy that wrote Jurassic Park, a bunch of other books like that. He also created the TV show ER. And Gelman amnesia, he described it. He wrote this treatise on this in the 70s when people read newspapers. So he used newspaper as an example. He said, Gelman amnesia is when you get a newspaper and you look at the front page and you read a story. And the story is about a subject that you're well informed about. And when you read it, you go, well, this is bullshit. You know it's not right because you're informed. You turn the page, you read another story that interests you, but you're not well informed. And you now take and believe the information you read. You forgot what you remembered when you turned the page. You forgot what you knew. Because if the source gave you false information about what you knew, then the source should be suspect for all other information that you do not know. And that's a perfect example here. Like, I'm not going to question what you're going to say about what's going on in the Middle East in the area you are because you're watching it. You're more informed than any of these people. But on the same token, since I work with people in the agricultural industry directly in the United States, I know that these migrant workers, so the thing you're being told is from a source you cannot trust. And we're all subject to this because it has gotten worse. The whole, I believe the whole thing now isn't even to lead you to a specific conclusion. It's not that they want everybody to believe the same thing. They want us all to fight. They want us all to argue. They want us to all scream and shriek at each other like a bunch of nincompoops because then we're easy to control. Then we're easy to manage. We just keep people, like, I'm sure you've seen the cartoon of, like, the people with the pitchforks and the torches and they're about to raid the king. And the guy's whispering in the king's ear. He goes, sire, all we have to do is get the pitchfork people and the torch people to fight with each other, and you'll be fine. And I think that's exactly what's going on at this point is how do we keep the masses divided? Because most of us, by and large, actually want the same things. Of course we want good food to eat. Of course we want clean water. Of course we want our kids to grow up without having to be, you know, shot at or beaten up or picked on. Right? Of course we want our children educated. Whatever that means to the individual, we can all agree. Like, okay, can we start with reading? Can we start with a kid being able to read and do math and having a basic command of history and science? If we can do that, I think most people want that. So since most people want the same things, but you want people in conflict, you have to create this divide. It's a design principle, actually. It's a malicious design principle, I guess. But Gelman amnesia, that's what you're looking at here. That's why people trust a source, because they don't know. Right. So, hey, it's in a paper or it's on a news site or it's on the TV. It must be true. No, you know, it's not true when it's something you know about. So how can you trust the same people? But we do it. It's just intrinsic. I mean, look at, I mean, if you didn't wait, I know you did, so I don't mean this personally, you, I'm talking about like in general. If you didn't wake up during the propaganda under COVID, I don't know that there's any hope to wake you up. I mean, you're in that deep snow white sleep at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, most people ignore what they need to know. And they're kind of in a toxic soup, and they've got to step away from it.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually got to take a step away and look back and go, wow, I'm soaked in that. I'm in that toxic soup. Yeah. Information and literally toxic. Yeah.
How vested are you, right? Because like my wife was a nurse for over 20 years, pediatric nurse. I couldn't tell her anything about the risks of vaccines. Couldn't do it. Wouldn't listen. Because she's out there doing it every day, and she couldn't accept that maybe she's part of this system. When she retired within 2 years, did you know this? Did you know that? Did you know this? Did you? And she's way more anti than I am now.
Yeah.
But she had to separate, right? And so you look around, and then you've got the divide and conquer model. Then most people are vested into some part of the system. There's some piece of it, you know. There's millions of people that work for federal and state governments. So they're all vested in government on some level, even if they say they're not. Well, of course you are. That's how do you get your paycheck, right? Where does your money come from? And then, or you work for a company. Let's say you work for Caterpillar. Okay, great. There's a lot of great things we can do with that equipment, but who's your biggest customer? The industrial agriculture world. Well, you're only going to tolerate so much negative about the thing that puts the food on your table for your family, especially if you live in the middle of the Midwest in a place where if you work for Caterpillar, you have the best job you can possibly have in your town. And there's so much of this, and I do believe it's by design.
Hmm. And there are countries where it's, you know, the countries are demonized, but they have some control of this.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It's quite unusual. And then we demonize those countries because their monetary system or their belief system. And they're all our enemies. I mean, look what's happened with China. I mean, China's turned around, you know. But China hasn't gone to war with anybody much. Now we're creating demons in that direction.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last place China invaded, and I'm drawing a blank.
Well, if you look at Tibet, there's an issue with Tibet.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's valid. That's valid.
Otherwise, it's 2,300 years, I think, since they went to war with anybody. And Iran hasn't invaded anybody. And there was a funny thing. We have aid work still in Iraq, and they had the school examinations, the high school examinations in Iraq, and they were worried that, like, you know, their students were cheating. They're using the internet. So during the 2 weeks of the school examinations, they shut the internet down on the whole country.
Hmm.
Can you imagine?
There'd be riots here. There'd be people swinging from lampposts.
Most of the things
lined up and because somebody hung them from the lampposts. I mean, like, no, that would be full-on rebellion. There is no way.
But they people said, okay, that's all right. That's a good idea because we don't want, you know, we want the kids getting that genuine pass in the tests. And the same with Iran shut the internet down once Israel started to attack. So we don't want, you know, false information coming at us. We'll just shut it down. There's no point in it anyway. We do what we have to do, and then we'll open it back up again.
Hmm.
Now, and people criticize these systems, but, you know, have you got a better model somewhere? You know, there's good pros and cons everywhere we could take examples from. Someone saying they're Vietnam, China invaded Vietnam briefly.
I'm not sure about that. Are they thinking maybe of the Korean Peninsula during the Korean conflict in the 50s? But that was after the U.S. forces pushed the North Koreans across the Yellow River and were right up on. So that's okay. That would be valid. But I don't remember anything from Vietnam with China at all.
Hmm. Just. I mean, we've got to stay open-minded about what's actually happening. And if you want to go for, like, warfare, well, your country wins hands down.
No argument. I can't because I'm an honest person. So We've dropped a bomb almost every year since our founding somewhere. I mean, there's, I think it's like 38 years in a 250-year history that we didn't bomb somebody somewhere.
But you have this incredible ability. I mean, the can-do attitude of America, and we talked civil engineering before. Wow. You know, having worked in Mississippi and New Orleans and seen, you know, on the Mississippi River what the Army Corps of Engineers have achieved, it hasn't spread the water and soaked it in. It hasn't done what it could have done, but the ability, the volume of the check dams going into the Atchafalaya Swamp, you know. But then it's like this empire that, can it maintain itself? Can it hold up?
Yeah.
That's the impression when you get to America, when you look at the giant bridges and the buildings and things, but can it be maintained? You know, is it an empire on the extremities of its expansion and it's going to crumble because it can't keep up with just when you look at the military bases around the world? How do you maintain that? And I'm not sure who and where and how it changes at all. I mean, what Mr. Trump's done at the moment has been just shock and awe in all directions, and like, you know, and then withdrawing and going backwards and all kinds of things. I mean, no one knows what the hell's going next. It's like the emperor's got no wearing no clothes and no one wants to say anything. That's what it reminds me of. Like, it's like, what are you doing? I mean, there was all these promises and things, and some look great, and then some just changed, and then what is next?
I don't know what his deal. He's done some stuff that, like, I'm like, what are you, like, when he started talking about, like, taking Canada over as the 51st state, and you see that just kind of went away. Like, I think he's, the only way I can describe it, he's playing the madman to keep people off balance, which probably isn't the best idea for the leader of the most powerful country in the world. That's probably not a good idea. I'm just saying. But, you know, and taking over Greenland and all these other things, I'm like, and renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, like, is that really going to help anybody with anything? But the only thing I can figure is that's what the guy's doing. He's trying to put people off balance. But in the end, it's back to the whole system is dollar domination in the world under a fiat system and attempting to maintain something that is literally on the verge of collapse. Like, our monetary system cannot continue indefinitely. I think the whole thing's an attempt at a reboot. I know we're off the permaculture thing now to a degree, but we're nearly not because, you know, there is chapter 14 in the manual that addresses a lot of these things. And the solution that permaculture has to most of this is as much self-governance and regional governance as possible without someone that lives over here telling this person how to live. Like, honestly, I consider permaculture, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I felt like Bill did, except he didn't like the word. It's a very anarchist technology is what it really is. Now, I heard him talk about it once, and he described it as, if it was anarchy, it would be chaos, and it's not chaos. And I think we're just using the word differently, because anarchy is not necessarily chaos. It's not people throwing Molotov cocktails. It's an absence of rulers, not an absence of rules. And people largely self-govern within, like, the village to small town size. Like, people don't just let somebody go rob an old lady and get away with it. And I don't care where you are. You could be in India, you could be in Pakistan, you could be in the Middle East, you could be in South Africa, you'd be in Nashville, Tennessee, and most decent people, if they see somebody like rob an old lady, they're not going to let that happen. Yep. They're going to intervene. And the smaller the community, I guess, you know, what I'm talking about here is like where if you're in that kind of ratio where you know most of the people, then that stuff really doesn't happen because, well, now you're an outcast. You see what I'm saying? Like, now no one will have you. No one will. You have no choice but to leave. You're banished because you're not going to make it here anymore.
That's how tribal governance works in the Middle East. Predates the positioned rulers that we put into position. Underneath it is still tribal governance. So if something happens in a village, you can go to the police and the official legal system, or you can go to the tribal judge. And their governance is that, like, they'll make a judgment, and they're known as someone who they're very fair. they'll listen to both parties and they'll say, no, you're wrong. One person's wrong. You have to leave the village or pay a certain amount back as a sort of payment or a recompense. And then it doesn't go to the police. It can't go to the police once you've gone to tribal governance. Like if we walked away from Iraq and left it, within a few weeks, it'll be back to tribal governance. And they already have it. It's still there. And it's just like what you say, you know, like if anything bad happens in the village, someone has to deal with it. And there's like a tradition of people that are known to be very fair in judgment. I was really shocked to learn that stuff. But what we're talking about is repositioning some of that fairness into a community system. And we have, anywhere there's a democracy, there's a local government. So what I've got, I've got a permaculture group that's now 35 years old that I created. I just went to their 35th anniversary, Permaculture Noosa. And I started that out of desperation because there wasn't anyone local. There was no permaculture groups locally, and the one that was there originally that I joined had become an eco-village inland. So it was a vacuum. And I was scared of doing this, and I started it, and I thought about it a lot. That group is 35 years old, and for a long time I've been too busy to set up a startup kit. Well, Eric Sider now is in Sacramento. He worked with Nick Bertner in Texas one time. And we've been working on lots of stuff together around the world. He's done some great work. He's the best finisher I know. And we're all starters, workers, and finishers to some degree. Yeah. And his finish is amazing. But anyway, he's set up a not-for-profit community group within the local government area of Sacramento. So it's called Permaculture and the Local Government Area. And he's set it up so that it's a not-for-profit tax-deductible gift recipient, which we can't do in Australia, but you can in America.
Yes, we can,
And he's pulled it off, right? And he's very thorough. It finishes things very well. Anything, right? And even this legal system. Now, we did it in California because if you can get it through California, you can get it through any damn part of this planet, right? If it's a democracy, this basically works in a democracy because people vote some idiot into position or madman into position. And it starts at the ground level as local government and then expands out to a state government and then a national. Well, I looked all this up. Australia is not very big. It's big in area, not big in people. We've got 853 local government areas. You've got 19,000 local government areas. And our aim was to say, here's a startup kit. Anyone want to set up a local community permaculture group that shares all its happy little accidents and all its sad little failures and helps people feel more secure about the species, the houses, the energy systems, the waste systems that we can all create for ourselves and share that info and set up local government, like local little demonstration sites. Their first demonstration site there in Fair Oaks is Fair Oaks Permaculture. People want to look it up. But they've just been given a small bit of land that someone didn't want to use with 25,000 cars a day going past.
Oh, wow.
And they're setting up a food forest, and they're going to do swale by swale practical workshops, all volunteers, like all putting stuff in. That's part of their action, where they're having monthly meetings. I've been dreaming about doing this, but I've just been too damn busy, been pulled all over the world. But now it's there. We're just about to release this, and it needs to happen. At least people have the option. It's like you've got to affect the local politician. The local politician says you can have a compost toilet or you can't. You can have fruit trees in the street or you can't. You can have a vegetable garden in your front garden. You can have solar panels. You can have. Who do you vote in that says locally what you can have?
Yeah.
I mean, in Louisiana, it would be a parish. You've got slightly different names for it.
You know? There's but a parish there. It's a city here up where I was from in Pennsylvania. It's a borough or a hamlet or a village, right? Like, there's like multiple names in the same state up there. I think it's really important to get the people vested in it first, because that's the restriction on the politician. So some examples I can think of: the urban farming guys in St. Louis transformed neighborhoods, and the crime in the neighborhoods went down. When people were coming outside and being part of the community gardens, the crime in the neighborhoods went down. I don't care if it's against code. You're not changing it because the people won't let you. Brad Lancaster in Arizona, in Tucson, transformed an entire neighborhood by cutting most of the most impactful thing he did was illegally cut the curbs and channel the water into wells that the trees growed in. Well, not only did they not touch it, Tucson now mandates a certain amount of water harvesting in new developments following his model. Ron Finley in South L.A. goes into these places, transforms these things, plants all these gardens, kind of guerrilla gardens, teaches the people to maintain them. The city code officials want to take them out. And there's literally gang members going, I don't think you're going to do that. And city officials going, I don't think I am either, because I don't think this is worth the fight. And these are all examples of people becoming so vested in the result that they defend the result. And politicians are really susceptible to not wanting to look stupid. I know that sounds weird because some of them really are. Those are federal people at a very high level that get away with their clowning antics. The mayor, the town council member, they do not want to be the person that's on the local news channel tearing a garden out that an old lady has. I'm not saying none of them will do it. I'm saying a lot of them really don't want, like, it's kind of like a third rail. Like, you don't mess with an Indian reservation. Well, you probably shouldn't mess with a community garden either, you know?
You've got a phone. Everyone's got a phone. They video stuff. It goes online.
Yep.
But there's this phenomena. You might have a few hundred members who join a group, right, and they get a newsletter online, which is all easy today, and they get informed. And maybe we have, like, you know, garden workshops where people get a garden put in for free because they've attended other workshops. There's different models that we use. But yeah, if you get 100 people that regularly meet, now it might only be 50 people that regularly meet, but 50 new members that come to a meeting. If you get 100 people in a room and they look like a permaculture group, now a permaculture group is a real mixture. It's like the course I've got here now. They're all different age groups. They're all different backgrounds. They're all different professions. They've just got one thing in common. They're thinking people that don't mind having a go at changing the world for a better place and a healthier place. They're sitting in that room. And at voting time particularly, a local politician comes and says, oh, there's this local community group that gets 100 people meeting every month. Mm-hmm. So 100 people a month. Okay, well, that's interesting. You don't get 100 people meeting once a month for a non-community group meeting. What do they look like? I'll go and visit and I'll promise them some things to get elected. When he walks in that room and sees that diversity of people, the first thing he wants to know is, how many actual members do you have? And then they go, oh, there's probably 20 people in my community that believe the same thing. That's 2,000 people. But hold on, they've got nearly 1,000 members. That's 20,000 people. If you multiply it by 20, because that's how they think, they say, yeah, oh, wow, if I don't understand what they're about, I'm politically dead. I'm going to get voted out. Like, this is a movement. And what do they do? Like, what are they about? Because this is a weird mix of people. When you come across a mix of permaculture people, it's a real cross-section of society. There's young people, old people, alternative people, different backgrounds, different cultures. It's a real mix because we are about diversity, and it works with the diversity of people. So your politician, he really wants to know, and then he promises you things. Oh, well, I get in. I'm going to mandate that we have more community gardens. We have more fruit trees. We have more sustainable waste systems. Someone's got, well, quite a few people, they've got the phone on them.
Yeah. Now you promise.
He promised this. He said this, or she, right, said this. Now, if we don't hold them accountable, if we don't demonstrate what we want as just the general public, right, there's nothing radical about it. It's completely peaceful. If we don't have a forum, we're not provided a forum like that. So we found this, we changed the whole region of Australia because of this, and it goes on. Now, you do need some brave people to start it. That's hard. Always starting permanence is hard because it's not supposed to be started. It's supposed to be permanent. That's the thing about a lot of permaculture. It's starting, it's hard. Once it's running, it's permanent. It's just easy to keep it rolling.
Yeah.
So we have been dreaming about this startup kit for quite a long time and getting all the legalities you have to do and where do we do it and where can we say this is what, and California was the one. When we looked at California, it's like, oh my goodness, the legality of California of getting past the regulations of water systems and houses, all sorts. So that's people, that's coming up. We've got it ready at last.
If you can make it work in California, you can do it anywhere. I mean, the things you like to do to a piece of property, if you came to Texas and the person outright owns the property, unless it's in the middle of an HOA or a subdivision, you can pretty much do whatever, anything you want. Now, there's things you can't do. You wouldn't do those things. So when I say you can do anything you want, I mean a person like you or me, we can do anything we want. We don't need permission. We can just do it. California, I mean, if you have a lot, I mean, Elon Musk said he moved to Texas because he wanted to build this new factory, and it would have taken 18 months before he would know whether or not he could. And in Texas, it took 18 hours to break ground.
Yeah.
And you know, I know there's, like, a lot of the people that have the environmental concerns, you and I do, they want more regulations, but the regulations aren't protecting the environment anymore. If anything, the regulations are making the environment worse because it's actually getting in the way of a lot of the solutions that exist. If you look at, like, all of the runoff from True Green Chemlon and stuff like that, it ends up in the Chesapeake Bay, and the onerous regulations they have up there, the solution to that is actually really easy. We could be growing food and fibers and medicine with the solution instead of just we're capturing it, but we don't know what we're going to do with it. Because all we're doing now is creating depositories of toxic waste. That's what their solutions do. So that's regulation to protect the environment. It may keep some of it out of the bay, but it doesn't deal with the problem. You know, fungi will break that stuff down, right? Mycelial nets will break that stuff down. But go try to build something that will actually do it, and the whole world will come down on you like a hammer. Yeah. And that's why I do think the smaller solutions like you're talking about work better, because they form these beachheads. And, you know, if you start forming beachheads, eventually they kind of start to merge together into, like, cells, like these community cell level thing. And people have to have a vested – people don't defend what they don't care about.
Yeah.
And to get them to care about it, they have to see the value in it. And beauty is something – even if you don't care about the food, beauty is something we all appreciate.
Yeah, your Texas is like our Queensland.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in New South Wales, which is the most regulated state, where Sydney is, and most industrious. But then in Queensland, you get away with anything. I used to be in Queensland, didn't need permit for anything. But once we build an identity, the step up from a community group is to build a bioregional identity. And we already do that a little bit. Like you have identities like Georgia as peaches, et cetera. And you know, like you have certain things, right? But we can develop that to a whole new level. Like, what's the process? What's the, you know, how is our production processed into other products, value adding? What is that? What identifies you in your area of Texas against, you know, a few hundred miles away, you know, and then this area to this area, this becomes your fingerprint. We are the people of the land identified by these primary productions and processes and personal skills. So we've lost our identity. We don't have an identity. And the only way to do it is to go back to the land and say, what has this land got to offer me if I conform with it, if I work with it, rather than what can I take from this land, right? If I work with this land, what is it to offer me? And then how can I value add and process that so it has value to my area? I don't have to ship it off to the other side of the world to process, or I'm just selling raw product that has to be 100% fresh. I mean, I can sell a tray of organic mangoes, 24 mangoes in a tray for $35. They have to be perfect, and they have to get to market in 2 days, which is quite a long way away in Australia. We're a problem. Yeah. Small population, large area. But if I take those mangoes and I dry them in a fruit leather, I get like $55 for them. right? But I can sell them next week or next month or in 6 months' time.
Yeah.
And I can knock them off the tree with a baseball bat. It doesn't really matter what they look like. If I get a little bit of work with those mangoes, and doesn't matter what they look like again, and I add a few ingredients to a little bit of cooking, add a jar and a label, I get $350 for the same mangoes because I've turned them into mango chutney. So if I value add and do a little bit of creative processing, I can go from $35 to $350. Right.
And make a product far more transportable, right? Something that you can actually get to a market, because you probably can't sell a lot of mangoes on Zatuna Farm because it's a waste of time
because it all gets lost in transport and movement and then things get spoiled. But mango chutney, consider I sell it next year. And actually that sort of gourmet niche market is really starting to take off. People are starting to look at these processes. My wife and daughter are making organic cosmetics. Because we have a health food clinic in Jordan, we're converting ladies in Jordan into organic cosmetics and organic health products because they're just on the verge of knowing the difference. Mm. So we are building a health food clinic in Jordan, but they're doing it here, right? They've got a still. They're still distilling oils and all these processes. My garage looks like a apothecary. They're on small scale, but they're building it out. They've got the label. But it's all from here. Right? You don't have to go to some French, you know, manufacturer of mascara, lipsticks, skin creams, all these things they've got, hair cream, conditioner, shampoos. They've made it all. They've just worked it out. But we don't process on farm anymore. We take it off. We just sell raw product. It's a mug's game.
Well, the whole game is how big can I get fast enough to sell it to somebody else and get out, right? And I actually think there is a ceiling on size to maintain the quality and the care. Like, you can't have a company shipping 18,000 jars of mango chutney a day and have an ethical-based system doing that. Maybe there's a way it could. I'm actually, as I say that, I'm thinking of ways you could make it happen. But it's not going to, I guess is another way to put it. But it's actually very easy to maintain an ethical distribution of a product where everybody in that company knows every single other person in that company and all the suppliers, right? Like, and I think there's a number. I can't remember it was a philosopher or mathematician's name that goes with this. It's the something number. And I think it's about 200 or 250. It's about how many people you can know where you know everybody in your community, at least to see. Maybe you're not friends, but like, oh, that's Jeff. Oh, that's Jack.
Yeah, it's 150.
Okay.
There are a few famous companies that divide all their factories into 150 people. And it's the same with a village. You know, 150 spaces on a daily basis. And then I totally agree. When things get too big, you know, they become unethical. When you see the way tomato sauce is made, you wouldn't want to eat it when you see the machinery that makes it and what it looks like as it goes through. But homemade tomato sauce, not that hard to make, and it's beautiful. Now, that identifies your part of Texas with your tomatoes, my part of Australia with my tomatoes, and that becomes we are the people of this land, and these are our tomato sauces. We make ginger beer out of galangal. Ginger's, we can grow ginger. It's okay. It's expensive. It's expensive for a lot of money. But galangal, which is hard to process as a fresh root, it's a relative to the ginger. It's the taste in Indonesian cooking. We just tried, wonder whether it makes ginger beer, but galangal beer. Same recipe.
Huh.
And it does. But no one makes it. But it's so easy to grow galangal where we are. It grows like a weed. And people pay a lot of money for it, $29 a kilo in the health food shop, because it's hard to clean it. But you can clean it with a pressure cleaner if you're going to make beer out of it.
Sure. I'm just thinking, I grow a lot of ginger. Maybe I need to try to grow some galangal.
Well, maybe it will grow there. But it's like there's just unusual, thoughtful things. You think, why are we not like – now you have these artisanias coming in. One of my shareholders here has – Fermentation Artesanias is the name of their company. And they make water kefir, which has a lifetime. But water kefir is so sweet, it replaces soft drink.
Huh.
It's as good as soft drink. I mean, soft drink's great tasting. I mean, not necessarily good for you with the amount of sugar you get.
At all, but it is good.
I prefer water kefir.
Okay.
But it's just it's through the lifetime. You know, you've only got a few days. It's like something that's brewed, right?
Yeah.
With water kefir. There are lots of replacements, but you've got to do it local. There you're forced to do it local.
There's an advantage there, too. Like, let's go back to ginger for a minute. So I grow ginger, and I get four distinctive products from ginger, but you can only buy one in the store, which is a mature root, right? Mm. I get the stalks that I use. They're a ginger flavor, but I use them the way other people would use lemongrass. I get the leaves, which make an incredible tea. I get the mature roots because I let some chance plants mature. But I also get young root that doesn't need to be peeled at all to use it, baby ginger. Now, most people have only ever seen one form of ginger that they would use in cooking, or maybe a jar of ginger sludge or something like that. But the idea that all of these parts of the plant have value, well, they don't. The reason you don't see them is they don't travel well.
Yeah.
But in that local bioregion, and where can you grow ginger? I don't know how it does there, but it does beautifully here. I have a friend that's growing ginger now in Tennessee and overwintering it in the ground, which I didn't think was possible, which they're doing with a combination of raised beds and deep overmulch. But I also have a friend up in British Columbia that's growing ginger for market in a high tunnel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a pretty – your Texas, Tennessee, British Columbia, that's pretty diverse. And then I learned about the gentleman – you probably know the guy in British Columbia. It's Curtis Stone. And – I learned about using all these other parts. That's actually why I started growing it. I'm like, well, where can I get leaf? Where can I get shaft? Where can I get the baby? You can't. You have to grow it. You have to produce it. But that could be I don't grow that much of it. I grow enough for myself. Somebody that was dedicated and wanted a food product, that's a whole, like, and Curtis, well, it was one of his friends he interviewed. Curtis is actually growing it in between the cash crops. So they're growing, like, tomatoes down the double row, and they're growing ginger in between them. It's like it's one of the most valuable products they're growing, and they're growing it almost as an afterthought.
Yeah. We get $68 a kilo. That's 2.2 pounds. $68 in the health food shop. No, for organic ginger.
Oh, wow.
That's how expensive organic ginger is here.
Wow.
When we grow quite a few garbage bins full a year on Zaytuna Farm, but we use it all ourselves.
Okay.
But someone I quote quite often because it impressed me is Eric Tonesmeyer at Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Because I've filmed his garden. I get on well with Eric. He's good. But he trialed 300 perennial food plants in Massachusetts that gets 2 foot of snow every year. And he settled on the best 200. He wrote that book, Paradise Lot. I wrote a review on the back cover. But most people don't think they can grow diversity because they can't see it. They don't see it in the shops. It's not marketed. And you know, it doesn't, you know, some either we just don't know about it, or it doesn't transport well or something like that. So I have to tell people, like, it's not just the tropics that grows diversity.
No.
And if you go down this rat, and they say, where do I get it? And I said, well, you go down this rabbit hole and find other growers. You'll find they are there. There are people who are just chasing diversity. It's not, you're not going to get it in Walmart. It's not an big open market system, but it is there. And if more of us support those growers, you just get more growers. You extend it by growers. So that's. You know, that's all I need to know about, you know, what we can produce in a cold climate in a small area. And I mean, you know, Eric's on 1,000 square meters, a quarter acre lot.
Everybody needs to read that book, by the way. I think I did a review on my site about it, like, I want to say 10 years ago. I remember reading that book. I read it twice, cover to cover. The story, the way he, like, blends the story into the education in that book makes it a really easy read. And as I'm reading it, I'm just like, oh, I got to try that plant. I got to try this plant. And did they all work here? No, but a lot of them did. And, you know, like, that's what we all need to do is the more – how can you try growing something if you're not even aware that it exists or that it's useful for food or medicine or fiber or something else? Like, you're just the base knowledge of finding out that these things – and some of the best stuff to grow is ancient. It's not really been bred much. Like, I don't even know the right name for it. I've been growing something here that is marketed by Baker Creek as Indian – snake bean or python snake bean, and it's actually like a gourd, and it's there isn't a pest here that'll touch it. Like, nothing will mess with it. The leaves almost smell like peanut butter. It grows these great long, huge, but fairly small, like maybe 3/4 inch round, look like a giant bean. That's why they call them that. And you peel them, you throw some salt on them and olive oil and fry them, and they're freaking delicious. And if you let them mature, the seeds in this thing, they get like this, it almost looks like something from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, like the 70s movie. Like, it's like this red pulp that can be used almost like tomato paste. And then the seeds, you know, obviously you use those to propagate the species to the next round. No one's, as far as I know, this has never been like selectively bred. It's just people started using it. It was a native plant that people started using. And it's freaking phenomenal.
That's probably a Joseph Simcox capture.
Yeah,
the potential explorer of Baker Street, but it's probably a cucurbita,
It is. It's in that family. Now, the one problem I have with it here is right when it really hits its stride, it's got such small. The flower's not that small, but the flower looks like something from a Star Trek episode, and it's got such a small reach down into the pistil and stamen that only nocturnal moths pollinate it.
Right. Okay. So,
It'll boom, and then I don't get production until like late August when it starts to cool off and the moths come back.
Right.
It's a weird, but it's worth growing because you don't have to do anything for it. You just, like, what you have to do is give it enough place to trellis it because it'll grow 20 freaking feet long vines on it.
Put a little LED light out there.
Yeah.
And see if you attract moths.
More moths, yeah, because it's so tiny, like. It's like you'd have to be – I'm sure you've seen how they, like, manually pollinate vanilla. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, like, specially trained people could do it. Like, it's not like a squash where you can just grab a male blossom and dab it and go on your way. It doesn't work that way.
See, that's your bioregion, and it might stretch a bit north, but might not go all the way to Holyoke, Massachusetts. And then
probably not. There
stuff there that some will come your way, but not all of it. So we are – this is what we've got to realize. Unless we trial everything, and we're just the tip of the iceberg. We really are. I mean, there's so few crops traded on the stock market. Now, soybeans, rice, wheat, maize, and potatoes, 5. But there's 5,000 that we could be growing. They're not necessarily going to be traded on any stock market because that's so big it doesn't make sense almost. But individually, to identify ourselves, secure ourselves, make ourselves feel physically and psychologically secure, we have to engage in this. There you go. Right, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen that plant.
There are some cucurbitaceae that look a bit like that. I mean, look a little bit like that.
Yeah.
But it's not a bean, is it?
No, it's not a bean. They call it a bean, but it's – and that's the flowers. See how those flowers are? They look – they're very cool. But see that it's a very deep – and that's – they're smaller than that picture would indicate. And so the moths have that really long appendage. I guess it's like a tongue that they can unfurl and get down in there with, and that's what pollinates them as nocturnal moths. I've seen hummingbirds hit them too, but they don't seem to do it. I'm sorry, they don't do it enough to get it to take somehow. Maybe they're not actually doing it. Maybe they're like, screw, I'm out of here. I don't know, but it's only like I'll get a few of them in like late May, and then I won't get any. There's plenty of flowers. There's plenty of female flowers, and it'll be the end of August. They'll start setting again.
Have you seen our native bees?
Your native bees now.
Now, before the European bee, all our trees in Australia were pollinated by these tiny little black bees. They don't have a sting, but they do bite a little bit, hardly feel it, but they have a nibble. The boxes, the bee boxes are about this big, tiny little box. Right? There is a beekeeping thing that people keep these native bees. when you take the honey out, it's a spiral comb inside this little box. You've got to kind of half destroy it and let them rebuild it. But they're tiny. They're like, 1/16 of an inch. And they go right down in that hole. They're a miniature thing, funny little thing, but they pollinated everything before the European bee arrived. And we have them in the food forest. It's kind of a medicinal honey. It's a little bit more like a medicine, full of minerals, because they go to all these trees. But they're tiny. They go straight down that flower. They'll be down inside it. But you're not likely to get anything like that there. But if I get some, I'll check that out. If we've got it available here, I'll let you know. See what happens with the native bees getting down in there.
Manifest themselves, who knows. We do have mason bees here, which are about half the size of a honeybee, and they're one of our native pollinators. And I mean, the U.S. the same. There was no honeybees in North America or South America. They were all brought over. We have massive amounts of native pollinators, but they're been damaged and set back a great deal by agricultural practices. And that's the last 35 years. I remember when I moved to Texas from Pennsylvania, I had this beat up old pickup truck, and I had to pull over going through Oklahoma and the Plain States and like manually wash my windshield because I couldn't see because of the amount of insects hitting the windows. And now you can make that drive and you barely pick up anything. And people think that's good because, well, it's not eating the crops. Well, you know, they're not all problems. Most insects are not problems. And, you know, I've learned a lot from Alan Booker that, you know, you get the Brix levels in the plants up and, you know, the insects are eating those plants because they're insect food.
Yeah.
You know, you get Brix up over 10, 12, and that's the end of it. They don't touch it.
Predator habitat, and there's no game. You know, welcome to the estrogen drench. As pesticide, fungicide, and herbicide, all the killers, what kills pests, what kills plants, what kills fungus, the scientists in all their wisdom have set all those up as a estrogen analog. So the one commonality in the groundwater that you're all drinking and we're all drinking has got estrogen in it. So you're getting a very strange sexuality change and infertility. So as you go to the countries with these are interesting facts that people don't just like edge stink it out. In every country, where the richest farmers are per capita is where you have the highest cancer per capita. Doesn't matter which country. It doesn't matter at all. If you go to India, right, it's, you know, you've got all the rich farmers up near the Pakistan border there, right? Every day a train leaves right across India called the cancer train, full of cancer patients. If you're in Australia, it's actually northwest Tasmania. Right? That is where the richest farmers are. There's the highest cancer per capita.
Yeah.
So, and then in those same areas, have a look at how many IVF clinics there are where people can't get pregnant. Look at the numbers. The richest countries which consume the most industrial product have the highest IVF. And where you'd have no problem with fertility, it's where the poorest countries are. Actually, it's where people are suffering the most, where people feel extremely poor, or the ultimate is a war zone. In a war zone, there would be no infertile women in Gaza right now.
Mm-mm.
None. It would be impossible because they think they're going to die tomorrow. Right? Now, if you look at the extremities, which we have to do as designers, and you go global, it's like, what? Why isn't anybody looking at this? Because, again, there's a money issue involved, right? With no consequence. Somebody should have the conscience, but the consequence of this has to be really someone is making decisions and they're not taking this into consideration. So it's kind of crazy that you see that. The poorest countries, where I live in the Dead Sea Valley in Jordan, which is the richest farmers are in the Dead Sea Valley because a lot of Jordan doesn't have good soils. Again, highest cancer rate.
Mm.
And particular cancers as well. We are the guinea pigs. If you see thyroid cancer, if you see goiters and thyroid cancer, you know, you can track down what it is, which I have to do quite often. And if it's not iodine deficiency, which you will get where you get very heavy rains or people don't eat enough fish, or there's no iodine in salt, but if all of those are present, you have a dry land, dry climate, and people are eating salt with iodine in it or enough fish, it's radioactivity.
Mm.
The only other thing. You know, and quite often I go into communities and like kidney failure, right? You've got kidney failure, a lot of it. Has anyone checked the salt in the water? No. But the Ministry of Mining, who do the, you know, like drilling for water, they don't talk to the medical department. They don't talk to the health department. They don't put the two things together. But in permaculture, that's our game. We make connections, good and bad. Mm-hmm. So we can make decisions. But frustrating, but when we get, like, we need more and more people to share this information. We need to use the it's kind of socialist, really. I think of it like that. It socialist truth is social media. We call it social. Social yeah. Media is like you're reporting the truth because it's your high-quality phone that's making the, you know, making the report, and more of us need to be reporting in and holding politicians accountable. I mean, we do vote them in. I think we do. I'm not sure that we do.
Yeah, I don't see it. Here's my problem. I think you usually end up with a choice between two, and you're going to get different words and the same result with both. And then to hold them accountable, what does that mean? Now, maybe if it's a mayor of a town with 2,400 people, maybe there's a hold them accountable. Okay. If it's a congressman who's been in office for 12 years and the accountability is they're going to get voted out and they're going to lose a $185,000 job and go get a $750,000 a year job as a lobbyist, how much holding the feet to the fire has been done? Yeah. And when they know, that's my exit strategy, right? Like, if I get voted out, I'll just go be a lobbyist. And there's literally a line of people waiting to hire them. And the longer they're in office, the more valuable they are because the more people they know, the more they understand the process. And it's, I mean, lobbying in the United States is legalized bribery. And it's today to drop things on Jeff, we have a system in this country for the House anyway, one side of the legislature called the party dues system. And let's say Jeff Lawton runs for a congressman in Georgia and you get elected. The day you walk in for your freshman briefing, they hand you a binder of people to call and they give you a bill. That's how much the party spent to get you elected. Go over across the street to the fundraising building and pick up the phone like you're a telemarketer and call the people in this binder and raise enough money to pay off your bill, or you can't do anything in Congress other than vote yes or no. You can't sponsor legislation. You can't create initiatives. You can't sit on committees until you pay your bill. You can't do anything. Now, the people in that binder are going to say yes. They're going to be happy to take Congressman Lawton's call, right? They're party regulars, but now you're beholden to them. The yep. system is designed. What I said when you were talking, perverse incentives create perverse actions. And we've created a system based on perverse incentives. People follow incentives. You know, why did people go west and dig up gold? Because you got money for it. So if you create an incentive that is a perverse incentive, you can't help but get a perverse output. It's one of those things, like I love the idea of holding them accountable. I used to say that all the time. I just don't believe it's doable anymore. I think it has to be on the ground, boot level actions that create, like the way you hold them accountable is, I'm not going to let you change this. I don't care what you say. You're not coming into my community and you're not touching this. Like those people you talked about that said, go away. You can't. We've lived in the same house for 2,000 years. Go save yourself. You can't teach us anything. Like you have to create that kind of backbone in people. Like I don't know how much you're into movies, but there's an old movie I really love called Tombstone. Val Kilmer was in it and what have you. And there's a scene in it where the sheriff comes up or the marshal comes up to Wyatt and says, you're all under arrest. And Wyatt just looks at him and says, I don't think I'm going to let you arrest us today. Like, we need that kind of subversive spirit reinstilled in people. And I think it only comes from natural systems.
Well, if you do start at the smallest level, like you say, on a small area, you're on a local government group, you stand a little bit more. It's like starting with
you
a small
can do
group.
That.
Now, if 19,000, I'd like to make a map in Australia, and you can make one in America, and color it in as we get a permaculture group in every local government town. Like, send it out as an initiative. Let's color this damn map in.
Okay.
Let's help you. And let's help you by sharing what we do, sharing how we do it, sharing how we help all the different systems that are working, good and bad. You can share locally what gardens work, what houses work, what energy, all the things you need. But at a local connect, at a connected level between this sort of startup kit to established local groups, we can color those 19,000 in. If the government sees that coming, I don't know what they do, but
yeah,
it's like, oh, we need to listen. Maybe we need to listen to this guy. This is getting to be a national voting block. And maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but that's what I think we have. It's like small gardens. You're not going to get anybody growing that snake bean in agriculture.
No.
But
it keeps beautifully, right? Like, a lot of the stuff, the problem is it doesn't keep. This, I keep them in my garage, and they last a month and a half, 2 months before they start to go off.
There's no farmer listening to this is probably going to do it, but there's probably a lot of gardeners that are already pressing that Baker Street field. I bet their sales pitch just went up, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we've got to find those sort of sneaky strategies. Bill was a great subtle strategist. People didn't realize.
Yeah, he was.
He was a strategist, and he used to – I think he stuck me in position with a sneaky strategy. I didn't see it coming. I think back about it. I think you probably did that on purpose, you bastard. Right? When I talked with him, he made me look so good. And I know he speaks better than that. I know he
did. He was really good at what I would call positive propaganda. Like, he literally infected my mind. Like, I couldn't not think about this. I couldn't not see this. I got to a point where I couldn't drive by a hillside and not go, swale, pond, like, I could not do that. I couldn't. And if somebody asked me, I could not teach. I couldn't walk into a garden center at like a big box store and listen to some moron telling some old lady how to get keep her tomatoes from getting blight and not go. I wouldn't interrupt. I just wait, ma'am, come over here. Let me talk to you about this. Like, I could not do that. And he was a big part of that. He had this weird subversive thing that he could do just by I don't think he did it intentionally. I just think he might have done it to you intentionally. There's no way he could have done it intentionally to me. He'd never met me. But he did it anyway, just with his teachings, his writings, his videos, right? Like that Global Gardener series, I think I probably watched that when I first discovered it. Like, and it was old at the time. I probably watched it like 8 times through all 4 of them. Because each time I watched it, I picked up something else. He was a unique individual, I'll put it that way.
Infectious. He made it an infectious system, and he allowed it to happen because he disowned the ownership. He made no money out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
He actually he announced his death to his relatives, and met them all in a lawyer's office and said, "Consider me dead today. You're getting your inheritance now. I walk out of here with nothing but the clothes I'm wearing, and everything now. All money I handle now will go through the Permaculture Institute." So you couldn't attack him because he owned nothing. It was a very Gandhian type of approach. That was a strategy.
I remember him saying, "I made damn sure the universities couldn't get a hold of it." He wanted no one to own the concept. He wanted it to be out in the open for everybody.
It's a wild system, and that's part of its great success, and why nobody's bothered setting up another system with another name much.
Yeah,
I mean, many things fit in it. People now talk to me a lot about different systems, you know, that come up, Syntropic, you know, and we can analyze what Syntropic is and how it fits, and it's just, you know, a part of permaculture in many ways, and just a slightly different approach to application, but. If we can make it as infectious as we know it is, and it's terminal, there's no recovery. You're not coming back. You know, seeing the world through a different lens. You know, the lenses on your eyeballs have just changed. And if we can get enough people moving that way, it becomes a popular movement. It kind of becomes a people's movement. And I think that's what he actually wanted. He was not really political. He verged on it. But it was kind of like he did talk about setting up a permaculture people's party, mm-hmm. and his first intention was not to be elected, but to be able to write its manifesto, and people would read the manifesto, which was really the permaculture designer's manual.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he said, like, you know, if we just get people to read it, or we can get it permanently on television. He didn't know internet was coming. He didn't know that. He had no idea about that.
I've always thought that the chapter 14 needs to be completely rewritten for the information age, because there's so many things we have, like virtual communities and virtual nations even could be part of it today. The whole LET system had a weakness. It didn't have liquidity of depth. You can use a currency like Bitcoin today. It literally is like your LETs are your LETs because it's your Bitcoin, but it's in your control and it can't be manipulated. The problem with money isn't so much that the state has a hand in it, it's what the state does, printing it, right? By exceeding the underlying value. The whole point of LETs was since it was local, then it would only there'd only be enough of it to enable local trade. So the commodity itself became the cap on the currency. The problem was you got to get people to take them. And then we're all using different ones. So, like, that's just one thing. You can, like, setting up, like, all the foundations and stuff that he wrote in there. The speed at which you can do that today compared to when he wrote that, you have LegalZoom today, for God's sakes. And now, like, I never thought of this till this moment right now. Add AI to that. Add the ability to go into an AI unit like Gemini, put it into deep think mode and say, how do I do this thing in this area with these people? And these are what I have.
Well, you know what I did with my online course? And it's like, we have a strategy in my online business, teaching my online education business, is that and we have to update every 90 days, otherwise we're going extinct. That's the speed of movement. And we're going to have to increase that to every month, you know. But what I did was I set out to translate the Permaculture Designer's Manual, which is a huge read, and I've read it many times. So I took it sentence by sentence and sometimes just paragraph by paragraph. I translated what I think Bill was saying in modern terms. And I went through the whole book, and there was only a couple of things I didn't translate when he's being a bit of a, you know, he's being a bit naughty and he's talking about blue loos and different things like that, like blue rinse toilets. I mean, he's just being critical. But every bit, all the way through, right, I just translated every sentence or every paragraph into what I think he was saying, and then that's how I taught. It took me 2 years. It took me 2 years to film that. It was the biggest educational thing I ever did in my life. I'll never be able to do it again. I haven't got the energy to do it again.
No, no.
But I encourage people to do that. And I think you're onto something there. I never thought about this. Maybe sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, we could get AI to translate. What do you think it is? What do you think he's saying there?
What does he mean?
I mean, AI knows who Bill Mollison is, that's for sure. It knows what everything is. It knows what that book is. Right. And whether this is a copyright infringement or whatever, and maybe I'm going to get attacked for this, that likes everything else. But like, you know, there has to be a translation of that chapter 14 in the modern terms included, you know, like digital currency, etc. Because that, just, like you say, that just didn't exist.
It didn't exist. So, of course, he came up with something else because so this is like. One of the books I've read recently is called The Fiat Standard by this guy, Saif Din Amos, who's from Lebanon, and he's an economist. He's very, very big into the whole Bitcoin space. But The Fiat Standard is about how we ended up with a fiat monetary system. It's not really about Bitcoin. It's about, and what he introduces, when he talks about this proverb from somewhere in the Middle East, that there's this guy that buys this property, and there's a neighbor, and there's a wall that seemingly does nothing on the property. It's just there. And the guy that bought the property, it doesn't really separate the two properties because it ends before it actually does anything, and he wants to tear it down. And the neighbor who he's moved in next to says, tell me why the wall was put there. And the guy says, well, I don't know. He said, when you can tell me why it's there, I'll let you tear it down. And the message in that that he was using is to understand how to replace something. You have to understand the problem it was trying to solve in the first place. We have this tendency to look at something like fiat money. You know, they did that to enrich themselves. Well, they actually did it because you can't transmit 3/8 of an ounce of gold from London to Tokyo. That's why the information age began not in 1995. The information age began when we created telegraph systems and we put wires under the ocean and we could transmit information across the planet. So now we have a monetary unit, gold, that can't move. It's got great saleability across time. It holds its value, but has terrible saleability across space. So then you had to get into this banking system and this cartel system. So with fiat, now we could move money quickly. So when we look at chapter 14, what we need to be looking at is everything in there that it wants to replace. What was the original system put in place to do? What problem was it trying to solve? And you have to look at, like, okay, it's the enemy system or whatever, if you want to think about it that way. It still was trying to solve a problem. There's still a reason it was put in place. And the whole thing about, I won't let you tear it down, of course, it's a parable. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's that you will not be able to tear it down until you understand why it was built in the first place. Because then you can't address the underlying original problem and you're at a disadvantage against your adversary because your adversary knows why it's there and knows its strengths and will use them against you and you don't know what they are. It's kind of like martial arts. Like, I have to understand your strengths if I'm going to misdirect those strengths.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, the whole of chapter 14 is like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I had a hard time getting through it, honestly, because a lot of it was dated and a lot of it was unique to Australian legal system as well, right? Like, yep, certain things that were in it, I'm like, well, there's another way to do that here, and so it needs to be translated, but also kind of probably needs to be regionalized.
Well, the biggest section I quote is page 510, the bioregional resources. It goes for 2.5 pages.
Yeah,
I use that to sort of say, well, this is how we re-identify ourselves within the landscape as the people of the land, and now we reinvent everything else.
Yeah, like, that's I'm great.
So I've got to say, right, what do we need in this bioregion? I think every local government should use that bioregion resource list, right? As this is the information we'll provide our local citizens. They don't do that. We have to do it ourselves. But if they did, right, it'd be very, very successful. Now we can work out what we can trade. Now we can work out what our financial systems are because we know what our landscape has to offer us and how we interact with it. Bill talked about, you know, all of us being, we work in a land where, we have one career, but really we'd be much happier having five concurrent careers at the same time. Like one main job that we do, two minor jobs that we do, and then two jobs that we very occasionally do, like very rarely, once or twice a year. And then we'd be a lot happier, and we're either working with primary production from the land, processing the primary production, or services. Outside of that, there's only legalities and religion, belief systems and the legal system. But it really came down to primary production, processing the primary production, and the services. And you think, wow, that's getting concise. But when you think it through, which he always wanted us to do, think that through. That is it. There isn't anything else. So, okay, what is the primary production of our area that's sensible? What is the processing of that primary production? Loads of jobs in there. And what are our services? People's got to do mechanics. Someone's got to put up a fence. Someone's got to cut your hair. You know, then you break it all down. And then, like, well, it'd be nice if I did a bit of farming, or if I wasn't a farmer, I did a bit of servicing. It'd be nice if I had across the primary production, processing the primary production and services, and maybe you want to be one of the religious people as well or something, or maybe you want to get involved in legal systems. But, you know, there's not so many people in that area, right? The bulk are primary production, process and primary production is a huge one, and services. And then like, okay, now how do I rethink this? And then when I discovered it's all written down, he wrote it all down, page 510, going for 2.5 pages of lists. I couldn't get my head around it. I was like, well, I can't, I'm not a list person. That was the very first mind map I ever made in my life.
Wow.
I made a mind map. I discovered mind maps at that stage, and I did it across a whole wall of paper. And then I brought it down, and I've now got a whole video about it, an animation, because I had to do it for my online course. And I've given that out to people in all the countries I've worked in. It doesn't matter which country, it works. Because it's just like how we provide our basic needs and live sustainably within our ecosystem, within our bioregion. I mean, how do you define a bioregion? Most people do watershed. There are many ways, but most people do watershed. And the Hawaiians did it very well with their Ahupua'a system, was all watershed.
One of the greatest lessons I've ever listened to was you teaching the Hawaiian system of agriculture and like things like why they don't get wiped out by a storm and they're leaving the trees and the fish ponds and these, I don't remember what the word for it is, but these basically strips that run up the slope and you get to a certain place and you don't touch it.
Yep.
I don't remember what that system's called, but it was like people would look at that and go, well, I can't build that where I am. Well, of course you can't. That's what you're talking about. It's a bioregion. Like that was a system developed for the land instead of trying to bend the land to the system. Yep. Because what you get with that is sterilization. If I said to somebody, name a state in the United States known for farming, they'll say something like Kansas or Nebraska or Indiana, right? Okay. And the people that live there, where does their food come from? It doesn't come from there. It comes from all over the world. It comes from California, whatever. If they're eating anything that was grown in their backyard, it was turned into a flour or a paste or a syrup, sent to some giant factory somewhere thousands of miles away, and then brought back in a box or a jug. Like, there's no food in farmland. If there's corn, soy, wheat, potatoes, that's it. That's what's there. And people don't even eat the local corn and wheat and potatoes. They eat what comes from the store.
No.
So if there's no food in farmland, how's there going to be food anywhere else? I mean,
we had a feed a farmer aid program in Australia. Because there was such a drought, we were shipping hay bales out to feed the remaining stocks. All the crops were gone. The drought was so incredible. And when we got out there and spoke to the farmers, they said, we need food. I said, what, don't you have a garden? Oh, no, Grandma did that. We don't do that anymore. I was like, why not? And they said, well, we just don't do it. And I said, you need us to bring you food? And then when we advertised that in the city, help us feed the farmers, people said the same thing. Well, what do you mean feed the farmers? Don't they grow our food? No, they don't grow. They just send one product out. And I've had students in my class with children. Young lady, always remember New Zealand, so fertile, beautiful. And she had a family farm, 280 milking cows, and a young boy there. And I said, well, at least you can give him some raw milk. I said, what do you mean? It's a raw milk. Like you've got a great big vat of milk coming out every day. You know, you can take a jug out and you get some raw milk from these, you know, and we don't do that. I said, what are you talking about? I said, no, don't do that. I said, what milk do you drink? She said, we get milk from the supermarket. And you get 280 cows. You can just take it before it goes anywhere. Oh, don't do that. I said, well, at least he's got some good beef, eh? She said, what do you mean? I said, you've got 280 cows. You have to butcher 280 calves a year. Surely you put one of the little bulls over in the paddock, castrate him, get him up some meat in the spare bit of ground. You've got plenty of ground. No, we don't do that. I said, well, why not? I said, well, we buy our meat in the butchers. I was like, what? What are you? What? Think about it, girl. You're raising a child here, and you don't know where that milk and that meat's coming from, and you can have the best. It's like, wow, I never thought of it. What are you talking about? Your grandma would kick your ass for this, right?
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, and like feeding a farmer, I mean, it's like people didn't know what we're saying. Like, what do you mean feed a farmer? There's this disconnect. That's not what it was. I don't know how many people I have to explain how to set a broody chicken. Like how to get a broody chicken to sit on eggs, and they don't know that they'll sit on anybody's eggs. And you can keep those eggs viable for 30 days if you turn them over and keep them at room temperature. And yep. they'll all go under at the same time, and they'll all hatch in 21 days once you sat on them for 24 hours. And I'm saying to people, what do you mean? This is the gateway animal of domestic animals. We all start with chickens. It's the sensible animal to start with. It's been with humanity almost forever kind of thing. Your grandma would tell you off. She scolds you for not knowing this. Like, what? And there was a great statement there by Carl Hammer of Vermont Compost. I'll never forget his lovely, eccentric character, Carl Hammer. And he says to me, Jeff, because he does his compost initially with chickens. That's where I got the chicken compost system from. He said, Jeff, eggs, you don't need teeth to eat them. So babies can eat them. You know, geriatric people need them. He said, they're a foundation stone in a sustainability wall. I'm like, that was his take on eggs. And you don't know how to set a broody chicken? Like, what? You know, come on, you know, like, that's really losing it. And they've taken the chickens off us and put them in factories, and we've never produced more chickens and we never produced more eggs. It's exactly the same number that we've always produced per capita. They're like,
we're just separated from the production. Yeah. I was saying, well, while you're talking about it, we have chickens here, and my rooster became a problem. So he went to the oak tree. So I have like six hens, these Jersey Giants. And the only reason I even have chickens is because my duck coop, if I don't have chickens, I have to do the chicken's job and go in there and rake the substrate because it mats, because the duck's feet pack it down, right? So I get the chickens for that. But the chickens go broody. We hatch duck eggs with the chickens.
Yep.
They hatch the ducks and they lead them around, and they're fine until like the ducks go in the water, and then they're making that chicken whiny and noise like the what's going on. And they kind of look at them like, I guess I have freaks for kids, but they do as good, if not better, a job of brooding the baby ducks than a mother duck does.
Yep.
They're fantastic at it.
Hmm.
And they're not speciesist, I guess. They don't care. Like, that's my baby. I hatched it. It is the gateway. Like, any laying bird is kind of the gateway. And there's one that'll fit wherever you are. Anyway, we've been like almost 2.5 hours. We have been 2.5 hours. I want to at least let you have a shot here to let people know about your upcoming course before we wrap up.
All right. Well, I'm teaching right now, but my next course will be in southern Spain, in Andalusia.
Okay.
You'll see it on my websites. And the next course after that is in Hungary, English-speaking course in Hungary. Got a fantastic project in Hungary with big machinery and lots of land and a very radical system going in there. And then my next course after that is in Jordan. So I'm southern Spain, Hungary, and then Jordan. That'll be sort of September in southern Spain, October in Hungary, and then late October, November in Jordan. We've set up an apprenticeship system where people can do an apprenticeship for 10 weeks in Hungary, 10 weeks in Jordan, and 10 weeks here. So they get international experience, and hopefully it's going to now be southern Spain as well. So we're trying to give people sort of international understandings of landscape and cultures and variations of climates. Everything about my online course you can find in Discover Permaculture Online. I'm afraid there is two things I don't do anymore. You can't ask me about, and that's money and schedule. So I can't even give you the dates because I've dropped that. I do what I do, which is stand in front of people and teach and go online. So some things I've just had to like go, no, team, deal with it, because I probably get it wrong. But it's all online. Mostly you can find my stuff in Discover Permaculture. Track me down. There's more than enough information online about my stuff. But there's a point, you know, when I decided when I hit my 70s, it was like, okay, I'm a testament of pretty good health, and that's superfood. And you can find my stuff on Discover Permaculture and go from there.
Well, man, I really appreciate you being here, and I definitely understand taking a step back. I've just gone to not working Fridays. This is going to be episode 3701 of this show. And like, I finally, like, this year I was like, I need to design into my life more time freedom. As we all get older, I get grandchildren and, you know, I mean, I want to spend time with them and to do some things that are more for me, but I don't ever want to quit teaching. So, I definitely think it's a good idea as we, you know, I mentioned Alan Booker a couple of times. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to meet him, but God, I got to get you two guys in a room together at some point. You know, what he pointed out to me is like, he's a very well-paid consultant. He's like, if I don't get out of the way, how do my students make a living?
Yeah.
And yeah. I found that to be brilliant. Like a thing I like, then the other thing he told me is like, but I'd still do one or two very expensive consulting projects a year. Not necessarily total dollars, but by the hour, so that when I go do something for free for a nonprofit and donate it to them, I have a market rate that I can deduct from my income for my taxes. And yeah, I'm like, wow, okay, that's smart design, man. Bro, I appreciate you being with us, and I appreciate the amount of time you gave us. I really do. Before I let you go, is there anything else you want to say to people? Because the floor is yours.
Well, I mean, I never thought that I'd say yes to every consultancy and teaching invitation ever again, but I have this year because the state of the world just made me feel like I have an obligation even just to give it everything at least this year, and we'll see about next year. I am going to start a new project. I am going to start a new farm. I'm going to let this one go to somebody. What I've built here, I've already got a community here. I've built the community. I'm going to get out of the way and go for another adventure. How far I get into it, we'll see. Maybe it will keep me alive. Maybe it will kill me. I don't care. But I like to take on new things. I like a challenge. So stay tuned. I'll be into a new property soon.
And with that, folks, I'm just going to wrap for this one. We won't have a closing segment because we're 2 hours and 37 minutes. This is a Joe Rogan length, if not Joe Rogan quality level podcast. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month. Show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. Revolution.